This is Dr. Laura Calkins of the Vietnam Archive, Texas Tech University. I'm conducting an oral interview with Lieutenant Colonel Kay Bigger of the United States Air Force. I am in the Special Collections Library interview room on the campus of Texas Tech University in Lubbock. And Colonel Bigger is in San Antonio, Texas. Today is the 26th of January, 2004. Colonel, can I ask you to begin by telling where and when you were born?
Spokane, Washington, 11 October, 1932.
Okay, can you tell me a little bit about your family? For example, what did your father do?
My father did a lot of things. He was a very talented man. Even though he was not technically an engineer, he could fix or make almost anything.
Mm-hmm.
He worked for the Air Force for a number of years, initially during World War II as a link trainer specialist, did mostly repair kind of things.
Mm-hmm.
Worked for the Union Pacific Railroad when we lived in the Dallas, Texas during, not the Dallas, Texas, the Dallas, Oregon,
mm-hmm.
during the war, and one of his main jobs was transporting weapons and material from Portland, Oregon, the port to Umatilla, Washington, which was a Army ordnance depot. Rather interesting. We then returned to Spokane, and he went into private business with a company that he bought called Perkins Supply Company, which was kind of initially a water pump and a plumbing-related business for rural use.
Mm-hmm.
And we expanded that into a number of other lines, including enough to call it an agribusiness distributorship. And we had a office on one of the main streets in downtown Spokane. And it was relatively successful. I spent a number of years while going to college working there in the afternoon, and that's where I gained a great deal of insight into business and management and things of that nature that boded well for the technical things that I was getting out of Gonzaga University.
Mm-hmm. Your father's name was what?
Howard Ernest Bigger.
Okay. Yeah.
My middle name is his name.
Okay.
And I could tell you a long story about my first name, but I'll make it short. Kay is a rather unusual name for a male.
Mm-hmm.
It was not that way back in the 20s and 30s. And as a matter of fact, K-A-Y-E, with an E on the end, denoted the male version. The ladies have since stolen that from us.
There were some famous entertainers, I think, of that era, were there not?
Well, you're probably thinking of ones that had the last name, Danny Kay. There was a musician, Sammy Kay.
I was thinking of Kay Kaiser.
Kay Kaiser, yes. Now, Kay Kaiser did not use the E.
Yes, that's interesting.
Yeah.
Huh? It was Kay a family name?
No, I've been told that I was named after an English speedboat racer with the first name of Kay. And I'm not sure that's correct, but that's a recollection that I have.
Oh, was that your dad's interest? Did he have an interest
yes,
in that?
Uh-huh. Yes.
Was he a sailor of any kind out there?
He was in the Marine Corps.
Mm-hmm.
Served in the Marine Corps in China in the late 20s.
And did he stay in the Marine Corps, or did
no, he got out, I guess, 31, and met my mother, and I was born in 32, however that works out.
Mm-hmm. You were telling about family names and so forth, and I wonder if you could give a little bit more information about your dad's time in China. Do you know anything about his service over there?
Not much detail. He didn't talk much about that. I know that it is kind of a parallel. He was on the Yangtze River on a Navy, whatever kind of thing it was, and there was a Steve McQueen movie once.
Yes.
About, I think, what he was doing. He never talked much about that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was quite a famous movie in the late 60s.
And I always envisioned from the little bit that I knew about it that was, you know, excess for the swashbuckling and that kind of stuff, but that was the kind of thing that he was doing.
Mm-hmm. Did he talk about that very much when you were growing up?
No.
Okay. What about your mother? What was her maiden name and where was she from?
She was from Spokane, Washington.
Mm-hmm.
Her maiden name was Hansen, Gladys Marie Hansen.
Okay.
And she was probably the most significant influence on my life. Not that my father wasn't in many ways, but I probably spent more time with her, you know, breakfast and things like that after he went to work. Late night evenings that we would listen to music, and we lived on a kind of a plateau about 500 feet above the city of Spokane, and we lived on the edge and had a large, large picture window in the living room, and would listen at night to music with the lights off and look over the lights of the city.
How beautiful.
A very impressive view. Yeah.
It sounds wonderful.
Yeah.
Did your mom stay home? Did she ever work outside
the home? She primarily stayed home, except she was the business manager of Perkins Supply for the years that we had that. And even after we closed the downtown store and were no longer physically full-time actively involved in that, we maintained the name and continued to do some business out of the home that she managed.
Mm-hmm.
She did also, at a period of time, and that was another time when we were had much opportunity and time to visit together, I guess it was my... I guess it was when I was going to college. And she worked for a time as a buyer for the fashion department in the Crescent department store, which at that time was the only major department store in Spokane. And in her later years, and until her death, untimely death, she operated a laundry, you know, kind of a coin-operated laundry thing.
Uh-huh.
Or I guess, no, they didn't have coin-operated. She actually took the stuff and washed it for people.
She sounds like dry clean. She sounds like quite the businesswoman.
Yes, she was.
Uh-huh.
And I think I learned an awful lot about ethics and business from her.
Mm-hmm. Had she gone to a school such that she had a...
Only high school.
Education? Okay. And she was a Spokane native?
She was a Spokane native. And back to the Crosby... We didn't talk about Crosby, did we?
No, we didn't.
No, just before.
Sure. Go ahead and mention him now.
Well, the younger Crosby brother, Bob Crosby, and she went to high school together at North Central High School in Spokane.
Mm-hmm.
And dated a couple times. So I could be a millionaire, the son of the Crosby family, but that didn't work out.
Okay. And did she know Bing Crosby at all?
I don't think she knew him well. I think she knew of him, but he was a few years senior to Bob, and I think maybe had already flunked out of Gonzaga and gone to be a millionaire in California.
Right, gone on to his fascinating future.
That's a story I tell about. He and I went to school together. He got kicked out. We both played the drums. I graduated. And he made $1 million, and I'm still looking for mine.
But you were better educated.
I think so, yes.
Yeah, there you go.
I was not a star scholar, but I think the combination of business activity and a college, a good, tough Jesuit college where they don't fool around, gave me a pretty good education that I've later expanded to a Ph.D.
And I want to ask you about those things. What high school did you go to, though, first of all?
I went to a high school in a little town called Meade, Washington.
Mm-hmm.
It has since grown into the largest school district in the United States and one of the most respected. At the time I went, there were 30 students in my graduating class. And it grew from that. It extended over a very broad geographical area around Spokane as a result of a number of smaller little town school districts that just, you know, couldn't quite hack it financially, and so they all affiliated with the Meade School District, which my father was chairman of the whatever it was.
school board?
Not the PTA, the board. Yeah, the school mm-hmm. board. Yeah.
So he was interested in local politics then and in education?
Not really politics. He uh-huh. was interested in local community service
mm-hmm.
things. He one time considered running for a county commissioner, but he didn't like the political aspects of it.
Sure. Uh-huh. But he sat on the school board there.
Yeah, as a chair. Sat on a board for a number of years and became the chairman.
That's really
in some of its most rapid expansion. Yeah, kind of interesting.
Yes, it is. Very interesting. In this very small, at that time, high school, did you play sports?
Yeah, but not very good.
Uh-huh.
I guess track was my big thing. I wasn't really interested in that much in sports,
uh-huh.
but I was the student body president and very active in journalism, public speaking, that sort of thing.
What kind of a academic student were you?
Oh, probably a B student.
Mm-hmm. Was that because you didn't apply yourself?
Probably was. Lack of application mm-hmm. as much as I should have, and a variety of interests. In addition to being a student, I was a band leader
mm-hmm.
and very much involved in Grange activities. That's an organization of farmers. I was a future farmer of America kind of guy and a 4-H guy. So I had a wide variety of interests that probably kept me from applying as much attention as I maybe should to have strictly academics.
Mm-hmm. Were you thinking very much that you would go to college?
Oh, yes, definitely.
Okay.
I was going to be a lawyer. In fact, my first 2 years in college at Gonzaga were in pre-law. But because of the fact that I was in ROTC and the the Korean War was,
mm-hmm.
you know, hard at hand.
Yes, sir.
I saw that I was not going to have the time to finish the law school, which was a 6-year course. And also, it was conducted at night, and that conflicted with my activities as a band leader, which was how I made the bread to go to college. So all of those things kind of changed after the first 2 years in school, and I became a business administration major.
Now, what was your instrument, or did you have more than one?
I really didn't have an instrument. I was a drummer.
Mm-hmm.
I was the front man and the leader, not the musician
mm-hmm.
oriented person.
And were you good at it, though?
Yeah, very good.
Okay.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, we used to play little rural places, Grange halls and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And a guy that ran a chain of roller rinks decided the roller rink business was kind of going out of favor. And he converted one of them into a dance hall and selected my band to open that, along with Louis Armstrong and a Western group from Grand Ole Opry. Kind of heady stuff for a young 18-year-old.
I suppose so. That's pretty remarkable, actually. And you were making a little bit of money with this
yeah.
with this gig.
Yeah,
and,
as a matter of fact.
And how many pieces did you have in the band?
Oh, we went from, I would work with trios, if that was appropriate, up to 7 and 8 pieces.
Now, were these mostly, were they guy friends that you knew from school?
Yeah, they started out to be uh-huh. high school mates.
Uh-huh.
But as we went up the chain in respect in the community and in a degree of professionalism, my original guys kind of drifted off, and I had some of the best players in town.
And because you were working at night doing this kind of stuff, the night school for law was less and less
yeah.
like a possibility.
Right.
Uh-huh. And did you have a particular affinity for law? You thought that was what you wanted to do, or was it kind of vague? And
I think it was kind of influenced on me by my peers as a result of my prowess in speaking.
Mm-hmm.
And I probably wouldn't have been a very good lawyer because I probably wouldn't have done the research to the extent it would have been.
Okay.
I would have been a great courtroom lawyer.
Mm-hmm. Presentation-wise.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. That's what they told me.
Well, they're probably right. I mean, often you get a pretty good read from other people. They have a good sense of where you are and how you come off. Gonzaga was chosen why? as your undergraduate?
Well, because it was a local school, and I could stay at home, had my music profession, and it just fit in, and it was an excellent law school.
Yes, and still is a very highly respected law school.
Yeah. And a good basketball team.
Yes, sir. And both of those two programs, athletics and the law school, bring that institution national recognition, a higher profile than many other institutions its size.
Certainly.
Yes.
Certainly.
I should actually ask you what year you graduated from high school.
1950, June 1950.
Okay. Were you at that point concerned that you might be drafted into the military because of the escalation in Korea?
Well, no, because I had pre-registered for college, I wasn't concerned about drafted.
Mm-hmm.
I knew that I had an ROTC commitment and was going to wind up, you know, in Korea unless it stopped. So, yeah, all of those things were pretty evident and pretty well laid out and pre-planned.
Why did you choose the ROTC path?
Well, that was the way you got the deferment in order to stay and complete 4 years of school.
Yes, sir. Did you have an interest, though, in becoming an officer? Did you?
Oh, I think so, yeah. I can remember when I was a kid in the Dalles, Oregon, during the war. I had a little group of neighborhood friends, and we would dig trenches and that sort of thing. And I self-appointed myself as a major in the Marine Corps.
Uh-huh.
So, yeah, I think I had the interest.
Were there other family influences aside from your father's military service?
No, I don't believe so, other than the fact that my father's brother was also in the Marine Corps, but I was never very close to him,
mm-hmm.
nor did he influence me.
Mm-hmm.
I only knew that as background.
When you were a kid, though, World War II was very much probably something that you were, you know, trying to pay attention to and knew about.
Oh, yeah, being about 100 miles from the Pacific coast on the Columbia River,
mm-hmm.
We kids had our foxholes, and we were ready for them to hit us.
In case they hit the beaches, huh?
Yeah, then we beat them up with our wooden guns.
Can you tell me about how the ROTC program was structured at Gonzaga?
Yeah, it was a four-year thing,
mm-hmm.
2 days a week, classes, in addition to regular college classes. And every Thursday was drill day where we wore a uniform, and in addition to having an hour or so class, we would drill on the parade ground at Gonzaga.
What elements of it, if any, really appealed to you? Did you have fun doing it?
I wouldn't say it was fun. I did pretty well in the classes,
mm-hmm.
and I was not probably the best marcher. I wasn't on the drill team,
mm-hmm.
But I didn't not like it. But it was not the most exciting thing in my life.
Right, and your life was pretty full. It sounds
well,
like.
Well, that's right.
After your second year of college, you changed your major, it sounds like,
yes.
to business administration. And was that influenced by some of what you had learned from both your parents and their independent business efforts that they had?
Yeah, I think so. And I was not, even though my father was very, very technically inclined, I was not interested in being an engineer, which was one of the other major courses at that time.
Now, did you have the mathematics?
No, I did not.
Okay.
I did not do well in math and science.
Uh-huh.
And that's why I spend so much of my time today working with the Aerospace Education Foundation on trying to get kids interested in math and science. And we'll talk more about
sure.
that at a later point.
Sure, I'll just make a note. The business administration curriculum that you had at Gonzaga, what parts of it were most interesting to you?
I didn't like bookkeeping.
Least interesting.
I didn't like bookkeeping.
Okay.
As a matter of fact, just between you, well, no, you're going to publish this, aren't you?
Well, no, it will be available to researchers. See?
Well, it's kind of half a joke,
okay.
but it's halfway true.
Uh-huh.
I had my bookkeeper do most of my bookkeeping.
Yeah, it just didn't appeal
program.
To you.
No.
Uh-huh.
No.
Were the parts that you thought were especially useful, though?
Oh, yeah, I think so. Personnel management things.
Okay.
And I think that's why I've been in the personnel business, when I was on active duty, in a personnel business-related things, which we'll talk about more, I'm sure.
Mm-hmm. Yes, very much.
But I think that background helped me to really enjoy the personnel things, dealing with people. The other thing that I was interested in was radio and television.
Uh-huh.
I did some radio programs. Television was in its infancy at that point in time.
Yes, sir.
And I did a couple things on television, but I wasn't extremely photogenic, so I never pursued that.
Now, what kinds of things did you do with TV?
Oh, TV, just a couple of drama things.
Mm-hmm. Were those local things that you did?
Yeah, they were local things.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, KXLY was a studio. I think they changed their call letters now. Then I did some farm programs on another radio station.
Did you think that might be something you'd like to pursue as a career? Broadcasting?
I very possibly might have had it not been for the war and for ROTC and coming in the Air Force. And that's another interesting story we'll have to talk about.
How much attention were you able to pay? I get that you're extremely busy as an undergraduate. But could you pay any attention to the developments in Korea?
Well, I think the extent of what it was, you know, reading the headlines in the daily newspaper.
Mm-hmm.
I was not deeply into it.
Mm-hmm.
I was not philosophically involved or concerned.
Mm-hmm.
It was a war. It was the United States doing what our leadership thought we should do, and
mm-hmm.
that's the way we thought in those days.
Right. Now, your ROTC program continued throughout your undergraduate years.
Yes,
right?
It was Army ROTC.
Yes, sir. And how did it come to be then that you were commissioned in the Air Force?
Well, a group of us heard about a program that the Air Force had to take Army ROTC cadets, and if they qualified for flying training, to allow them to be commissioned in the Air Force. Out of the 8 or 10 of us that pursued that, I was the only one that did it.
Now, why was that? What happened to the other guys?
They just stayed in the Army.
Were there some tests that they, maybe they didn't
have? Some of them had eye problems and that sort of
sure.
thing.
Sure, uh-huh.
And then lack of motivation from the initial trip that we took to Parks Air Force Base for Air Force or orientation.
Okay, do you remember that orientation course?
Yeah.
Okay, how long did it last?
3 days.
Okay, what did you do during those 3 days? What would it mean?
Oh, primarily went to different lectures and did some physical things. I think we all took physicals there.
Mm-hmm. And you did rather well on the training element of it?
Well, it wasn't doing well. It was just listening and absorbing.
Okay.
There was no testing.
Okay. And the physicals, though, you passed those fine?
Yes.
Okay. And at what point, then, did you actually transition from the Army officers?
Oh, it was toward the end of my senior year.
Okay.
1955.
Mm-hmm.
I think it began in late 54,
uh-huh.
and I was commissioned, I believe, on the 21st of January, 55, by a brigadier general from what was then the other base in Spokane, Geiger Air Force Base. It was a fighter base.
Mm-hmm.
It's now the municipal airport.
Did you have to go out there for a ceremony of some kind?
No, the general came to the school, General Sam Agee, A-G-E-E.
He came to the school?
Came to the school, bet, just for me. How
yeah.
about that?
And you were the only one, right?
I was the only one. Even got my picture in a paper.
Super.
Yeah.
What was that experience like to have a general come and, I mean, just for you?
Yeah.
Was it amazing?
Well, somebody else arranged it.
Well, sure, but, yeah. I mean, his trip was specifically because of your transition into
the
Air Force.
He gave me the oath of office.
What did that feel like? Did it make you like a big man on campus?
Well, it was in my, you know, the last month or so.
Uh-huh.
And, no, I don't think it made me feel like a big man on campus. But,
it's pretty unique. My
grandmother saved the picture.
I bet she did.
Yeah.
were your parents proud of you at this point?
Yeah, my parents let me live a very independent life.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure they were very proud. They were never involved because I was independent.
Mm-hmm.
And I left in the morning to go to school and went to work in the afternoon in my entertainment business, which we haven't talked about either, came home late at night.
And you're pretty much out there making your own decisions and flying large there, I guess.
Yeah, I think so. But okay. With, you know, good backup and guidance and excellent support in anything I wanted to do.
That's super. Tell me a little bit about your entertainment business. Now you told us that you actually were performing.
Yes,
did you
I was performing. Then I was also managing bands and individual entertainers. For a company called the Spotlight Talent Agency.
Okay.
Where I went every afternoon after school, 2 o'clock or whatever, and worked, in the office with entertainers and that. And then also went out and helped produce variety shows at various venues.
So were you getting bookings for various entertainers
Yes.
in the area?
Yes.
And was Spotlight based in Spokane, or
Yes.
was it?
Yes, it was. Uh-huh. It was locally owned.
And did it have affiliations with the broader entertainment
Yes.
industry?
Yes, yes, with the American Federation of Musicians.
Uh-huh.
I was also a licensed talent agent from the American Society of Composers, Authors, and Publishers. And, we had all the affiliations, but we were privately owned. We worked with some of the majors, like Music Corporation of America and
yeah.
that sort of thing.
Uh-huh. And how long... Are you still available, sir?
Yes,
okay.
I'm sorry.
No, it's fine. How long did you keep your hand in the entertainment business?
Oh, I guess throughout college, and I later opened my own company that I ran for about 2 years called OK Attractions, doing the same thing.
Whereabouts is that? Still
Spokane, Washington.
Okay. And what years did you do that?
Probably 52 to 54.
Okay.
I think I did it after I went off to summer ROTC training camp.
Uh-huh.
And when I came back from that, because I'd had a break from the thing, and it's still on good relations, and we work very closely together,
uh-huh.
my former boss, John Greenleaf, and I, but I just decided I'd take a crack at it myself
it sounds like
make a little more money.
Yeah, sure, and it sounds like an extremely interesting thing.
It was very exciting.
Particularly since just at that point, television is just coming on board, and it's clear that there's this whole new... industry really that's developing, and local broadcasting stations were probably hungry for content, that would be my guess.
I never really got involved in that.
Okay.
What I was involved in was the other end of it, the dying end of it. We
okay.
used to book the big bands throughout Washington, Idaho, Oregon, Montana, and even into Canada.
Uh-huh.
But as you know, they demised in, right about then. That was about the end of the big band era.
Mm-hmm. Would you have worked with any names that listeners might recognize? Even regional listeners who might know something about that era and entertainers?
I guess I had a hand in booking most of the majors, both of the Dorsey brothers, not Glenn Miller, but Glenn Miller led by Tex Beneke.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Sammy Kay, most of them that came into the area. Spokane was unique because we were halfway between Seattle, which is the largest city in Spokane, and was very active on the circuit. Then the next jump was Minneapolis, Minnesota, and we would get them on Sunday nights.
Mm-hmm.
And the biggest source was a place called Natatorium Park, which was what was it? They had Ferris wheels and all kinds of stuff. And we would book the bands there and on the military bases, and I had excellent connections with the military bases. That was part of the reason I opened my own company, is because of my contacts with them, and most of the business the company did was with officers and NCO clubs and service clubs. at bases throughout the four-state area.
And there were a good number of bases in that area.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think probably 16.
And very busy, too. With
At that time.
With the build-up in Korea
so
on.
Uh-huh. Yeah, you bet.
That really sounds like quite an amazing thing. I sort of wonder that you decided to shift to a military career.
Well, I had to.
Okay, can you tell us why?
Because of the war and the commitment to ROTC
and
the commitment to 2 years active duty.
Okay, so once you had graduated and completed your ROTC and your mission in the Air Force, you had an obligation for 2 years?
Correct.
Was it of full-time service?
Yes.
And so you reported, I would guess, to
Lackland. Lackland Air Force Base in San Antonio, Texas.
And that would be for basic training, was it?
Well, it was officer orientation.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Can you tell us what the length of that course was?
Oh, I think the basic course itself was only about 3 months.
Uh-huh.
I did not. I came in to fly. I did not fly.
Why not? What happened?
I lost my enthusiasm for it before I even got into it.
Is that right?
And had an opportunity to go into the personnel field.
Uh-huh.
And because my motivation to fly was not, you know, a lifelong thing. I had a Piper Cub when I was 12 years old or whatever.
Uh-huh.
I took the opportunity to get in the personnel business because I thought I could really contribute more.
And that decision to just not follow the flying route was made when? When did you actually come to that decision?
Oh, I think in 55, just a few months after I was, after I came on active duty.
Okay.
I then went to Scott Air Force Base in Illinois for personnel school.
Yeah. Can you tell me about the personnel training? How long did that last?
6 weeks.
Okay. And what was the content? Can you describe what it was the curriculum had to offer?
Oh, wow. This is years ago.
Ancient history, huh?
I think all the basic elements of military personnel.
Mm-hmm.
I think the selection for people to go into that were ones that had not necessarily a minor or a degree in personnel management, but had a sufficient understanding of the basics. And so we were taught the military personnel system and how to administer it. And what broad overall agenda, that was it.
Now, you were
how to do morning reports, how to do officer records, how to do assignments, classification of people, things like that.
Mm-hmm. All the administrative back end of getting people into the field and operating.
And managing them in the field, which was what I then next did whenever we're going to get into that, if we're going to get into those kinds of things.
Oh, sure. I want to hear everything you have to tell us. I mean, this is actually very interesting. The selection of personnel training, was that something that someone suggested to you, or did you kind of pick that out as something you could do that you thought might be important?
Yeah, I don't remember that an exact process, but there were a number. They made me a transportation officer. And, you know, I didn't think I wanted to do much with driving trucks around.
Okay, that didn't appeal, really.
No.
Okay.
So when the opportunity came up to go off to personnel school, I said, that's better than driving trucks.
Now, by that...
Yeah, I'm joking. Transportation officers do far more than drive trucks.
I know. and we'll probably have a chance to talk about your interface with the different areas of administration and logistics later on in your career.
Okay.
At this point, had you weapons qualified? Can you tell us where you were in terms of...
Yeah, I think we weapons qualified during the three-month orientation at Lackland. M1 was a rifle at the time, and the .45 was a pistol, and the .45 pistol carried me through my career.
Was that your favorite weapon as time went on?
I guess so, because it was the one.
Okay.
In fact, that's why I can't hear too good out of my right ear from shooting that rascal.
Yeah, they lay on a wallop, don't they?
Then when we talk more, I'll tell you about virtually every other weapon that I qualified in.
Okay, good. The personnel course that lasted 6 weeks up at Scott, can you tell tell us of where you were billeted and how an average day was?
It was really neat because billeting was short, but they had an extensive civilian family complex. And so three of us were given a three-bedroom apartment.
Not bad.
Yeah, no, that was neat. Uh-huh. That was really neat. You know, we could cook and everything.
Now, you're...
I thought it was a pretty good deal. Yeah. Boy, the Air Force is all right.
Yeah. Your rank at this time would still have been...
Second lieutenant.
Second lieutenant, okay. At what point did you make first lieutenant?
18 months to make first lieutenant. Okay. I guess I made first lieutenant in July or something of 56.
Okay. So that's jumping ahead just a bit. After you completed the personnel training course at Scott, what happened? Where'd you go?
I was sent to Turner Air Force Base, Albany, Georgia.
Okay. And
probably the best experience, one of the best experiences, particularly for a young lieutenant that I've ever had.
Why is that?
I was selected to deploy overseas, initially to Hahn Air Base, Germany, with a fighter squadron. And I was a squadron adjutant, administrative guy. If it didn't fly, I took care of it.
And?
Very challenging job, for which I was personally selected by the wing commander at the time.
Okay. How long were you actually at Turner before?
Oh, I spent 3 years at Turner, I guess, in different jobs, which we can talk about when you're ready to talk about.
Sure. How about now?
How about now? Started off with the dullest job in the world, the chief of the morning report and pay section.
Okay.
But learned an awful lot in that, then moved over and got into the officer management area, which was very, very interesting.
Okay. The morning report, for somebody who wasn't familiar with that, could you just outline what
Yeah, that was a thing that they tallied up everybody by a head count in the squadrons, and we put all that together. One day I signed my name, they told me 13,000 times. I think they meant 1,300.
Oh, that's a lot of paper.
Yeah. That I never read. Impossible to have read it. I had to rely on my people to do things right.
Yes.
And I would do, you know, spot checks and that sort of thing. But I never would pretend to say I read through every one of those pieces of paper.
And after working in that section, and you were also responsible for pay at
that
time, too?
Yeah.
Okay.
That was a lot of fun, particularly when we had large large temporary duty things. And 100 guys would come back and all want their per diem.
Sure.
Now, well, it didn't happen quite now, but we would turn it fast, and most of them would have it in 2 days.
And you learned a lot, though, from that particular assignment.
It was kind of a dull routine thing, but I learned a lot from it.
And then after that, you went to what assignment?
Managing the officer section.
Okay, and describe your general duties there.
Ooh, lots of counseling, reviewing officer effectiveness reports, and sending them back to the dismay of the poor sergeant in the squadron who would have to type it over again because I found a misspelling or a grammatical error or something.
So
very time-consuming, but interesting work.
So you were doing some quality control on the paper end.
Exactly.
Well as offering...
counseling advice, handling assignments, processing people. I processed the people for the first U-2 squadron that the CIA had that was located in El Paso, Texas. Kind of an interesting little anecdote.
That's very interesting. Is there
Francis Gary Powers.
Remember
that name?
Yes, I do. He was shot down later, wasn't he, sir?
Yes. I put him into training for that.
You did?
Yeah.
How many people were in that group that were trained for the early?
Well, from our base, and it was from another wing, but I was selected by a wing commander to go off to 8th Air Force headquarters to learn the mechanics of what needed to be done and granted a top secret security clearance in order to handle that program.
Sure.
And I would say from Turner Air Force Base, we put about 30 people into it.
How were they selected? What special criteria did they have? Do you know?
Well, first they had to pass a top secret test.
Okay.
They had to be excellently rated
in
their flying abilities.
Uh-huh.
physical characteristics. We couldn't take big, tall guys. We couldn't take little, bitty guys.
Okay.
Because the pressure suits were standardized for basically a 5'10" to 6 foot, a little bit plus person.
Really?
That was a complex process. And sending them around different places in the country to be fitted for the suit.
Yeah. That was a governing feature that had
yeah,
to be.
Yeah, it was. It was one. Yeah. Uh-huh. There were limitations like that. Somebody would call that prejudicial today, but that's the way of the world.
Mm-hmm. Sometimes that stuff happens, right? What else do you remember about putting together those early units for training for the U-2? Did you have to know the characters?
Well, I had nothing to do with it after we got them through the initial indoctrination, the suit experience, that sort of thing.
Right.
I was not involved in the actual training of them.
Mm-hmm. But you had to handle the paperwork for getting them assigned to.
Yeah.
And they were all being assigned. I'm sorry. At what base for the training? For U-2 training.
They went to. Tip of my Del Rio, Texas.
Okay.
I can't think the name of the base right at the moment.
That's okay.
Del Rio, Texas, because it's out in the middle of nowhere.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir, it is.
It's where the world's most powerful radio station was.
Is that right?
Yep. And for $1, you could get an autographed picture of Jesus Christ.
Oh, really?
Yep.
You could pick up that much, huh?
If you mailed it in, you'd get it back. So I'll give you some idea of of the remoteness. And that was from the Mexican side of the border, isn't it?
Oh, okay. I'm with you. The U-2 flight training is interesting. Were there other special units like that you recall having worked on the paperwork for the men?
No, that was the only major program that comes to my mind.
Okay.
But shortly after that, I was selected for that deployment that I talked about overseas with a fighter squadron, F-100s, one of the first F-100 units in the Air Force.
I just wondered if you knew anything, for example, about down at Lackland, they were developing just briefly there in the mid-50s, the nuclear airplane. I wonder if you knew anything about that program.
No, I didn't.
I think they called it the AMP. Okay.
No, I hadn't heard of that.
That's something I'm interested in. I just wondered if you had come across
at Lackland. I wouldn't think it was at Lackland. Lackland didn't even have a runway until Lackland was combined a year ago with Kelly Air Force Base, and Lackland is now owns the runway.
I think maybe they were doing the design work down
there.
Yeah, that
could have
like
been.
Yeah. So you were selected especially for this tasking overseas to, was it Han Air Base?
Initially to Han. We stayed there 15 days and then went to Aviano Air Base in Italy, northern Italy.
Mm-hmm.
And this was all during the Lebanese crisis. We were there. We had two aircraft on standby, nuclear armed 24 hours a day, with the remainder of the 24 airplanes in the squadron to be off in 2 hours.
Those
testy days.
Yes, exactly. And were you actually at Aviano during this period?
Okay. Yes.
Can you tell us a little bit about what that alert was like? Did you have to change the personnel rotas and so forth in order to accommodate that high state of alert?
Well, 2 out of 24, you know, it was however the mathematics worked out to that.
You had those guys were ready, though.
Yeah, the other guys were flying regularly, daily,
mm-hmm.
on training missions.
Mm-hmm. But you had two birds loaded
right.
the whole time?
Right.
About how long did that last? That
we were there for, 2 weeks shy of 6 months. It was a 6-month rotation. We spent 2 weeks at Han, and you do the numbers, and the majority of the time was at Aviano.
Now, your posting at Aviano, did it allow you to get off base much?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Did you?
Except it was at times a little scary because the communists were very active in northern Italy.
Yes, sir. Did you ever encounter or see any of that?
I did not personally, but I had one buddy of mine driving a Jeep down the road. They put a piece of barbed wire across the road, and the windshield was knocked off. He was not injured. But those things were out there.
Yeah. And were there were particular targets being made of U.S. military personnel, do you know?
Not really, no. Uh-huh. We didn't have the kind of thing that occurred in later years. There were no attempts to attack the base.
Uh-huh.
The base was two different things. The main support base was up on a hill, and the runway was down in a valley.
Uh-huh.
And while we had security at the major entry points, the airfield was not totally secure, no.
Okay, but there were no incidents.
But we had guards on all the planes.
Sure, yeah.
Oh, in
yeah.
The major installations. For example, my office was in a hangar.
And you were doing what kind of work here, sir? Were you?
That was strictly personnel work. Uh-huh. Well, it was more than personnel work. As I say, if it didn't pertain to flying, it was my responsibility to see that it was done,
okay.
Including supervising the augmentees to the mess hall, supervising the security police. As a matter of fact, I don't think the base security police provided any security police protection for us. It was our own security policemen that we augmented and took with us.
Oh, do you mean that were attached to the squadron? Or?
Yes,
okay.
Yes, yeah, we're members of the squadron.
Uh-huh.
That was probably the first big task that I did
uh-huh.
when I went in, and maybe was one of the reasons that I was selected, because I had a good overall knowledge of people. On the base to select an interview to augment to take with us. The cooks, the firefighters, the security forces, some transportation guys, augmented maintenance personnel, that mm-hmm. sort of thing.
And you kind of had to put together the team based on your knowledge of kind of where everybody's strengths.
Right, exactly.
Why? Mm-hmm. Just for the record, which squadron were you with?
With the 308th Tactical Fighter Squadron.
Okay.
Of the 31st Fighter Wing.
Okay.
Which now is the parent organization at Aviano. How about that for a coincidence?
Well, there seems to be some symmetry there, anyway. Did you enjoy your time at Aviano?
Yeah, it was neat.
Okay. And you actually got...
I enjoyed the work and also... the little time that we had off. When in the fall of 58, when we were there, we rented a hotel on the Adriatic coast as our R&R site for our people to go to.
Uh-huh.
And in the winter, we rented a villa for them to go up to go skiing.
Uh-huh.
So it was, you know, hard work, but when the time was off, it was really a unique area.
Totally. Being from the Northwest, were you a skier at all?
No, I was not.
Oh, okay.
I used to ski in the bar.
Yeah, that's how I do it,
too. Opera ski, they call it, I think.
That's how I do it, too. Did the guys who were in the squadron kind of look to you, both formally and informally, for advice? Do you think
yes.
people kind of came
yeah.
to you?
Yeah, that was my job,
mm-hmm.
but it went far beyond that in terms of things non-military. For example, I was before the deployment, the treasurer of the credit union at Turner Air Force Base, a volunteer, you know, off-duty job.
Uh-huh.
And so I continued that relationship as a kind of an expediter coordinator, because everybody had to buy a Porsche, and
right.
they needed money.
Yes, sir. And you...
And so I, you know, processed their paperwork.
Uh-huh. You helped them on their way to their Porsche.
Right.
Okay.
I only had a Volkswagen.
Were you involved at all in making certain that your element of the Air Force was observing the desegregation rules?
It was not a big issue at that time.
Okay.
But later I was very involved in
okay,
that.
Okay, uh-huh.
So well, we can talk about that.
Yes, I'd very much like to. Were you also advising men on how to proceed for promotion and getting career paths kind of straightened out
yeah,
for people?
Yeah, I was. And one of my big things that not only I sold, but I really pushed it hard was to tell those dumb fighter pilots that flying an airplane was great, and they had to do that,
mm-hmm.
but they needed to have an additional duty, because it was the additional duty that was going to set them aside from the other guy to have experience and background to become a total concept kind of guy that would be better qualified for promotion than just the guy that flew the airplane.
Yeah, advising them not to be unidimensional, even if it was, you know, the hot.
Yeah, I spent a lot of time at that.
And was that a hard sell?
Yeah, to some guys it was.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
What kinds of things?
Depending on what additional duty I was offering.
Well, that's just what I was going to ask you.
Mortuary officer didn't go too big, so I had to take that myself.
You were the mortuary officer
as
well? Was that just at Aviano or elsewhere too?
I guess technically a number of other places I was a mortuary officer. I did not do any embalming.
Okay. Well, actually, while we're talking about it, what is a mortuary officer responsible for?
Somebody dies, you do all the paperwork and notify the next of kin, gather up all the personal articles, mail them to the next of kin, look after financial affairs,
mm-hmm.
and also make sure that the guy in the mortuary office did his job right.
Such that the
embalmer.
The body gets handled
yeah.
the way it's supposed
yeah,
to.
Uh-huh. You know, I didn't stand there and supervise. I knew
no.
nothing about it to make
no.
sure that it got on the airplane and,
right.
and got to where it was supposed to go.
So you were sort of...
Fortunately, I only had one guy that bought the farm at Aviano.
Really?
Yeah.
He
was one of my closest friends.
What happened? Was it accident?
Well,
or?
I think we determined it to be mechanical error.
Okay. Was he a flyer then?
Yeah.
Or,
yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. F-100 pilot.
F-100s were pretty much new out of the chute at this point. Is that right?
Would you say that again?
Sure. The F-100 was basically a pretty new piece of equipment.
It was. It was the hottest thing in the Air Force inventory at that time.
Yes, sir. How many of them were stationed there at Aviano?
24.
Okay. And these were the birds that were loaded with the nuclear capable.
Yeah, we can say that now.
Yeah.
I can't
oh, sure.
get into much detail.
No, that's fine. The pilots who were flying F-100s. What kind of background had they had to have to transition?
Okay,
to
we had three or four captains.
Uh-huh.
One of them, who was the operations officer,
uh-huh.
Was a Korean veteran, and he was an ace.
Is that right? Do you remember his name?
James Kassler.
Okay, do you know how to spell his last name?
Kassler.
Okay,
he's now deceased.
Uh-huh. He was an ace from...
He was an ace.
Wow.
Five.
That's impressive. That's really something.
Yeah, we had top-notch guys.
Yeah.
Another guy, Leo Thorsness. Let me spell that for you.
Mm-hmm.
Thorsness.
Mm-hmm.
Was shot down in Vietnam and was awarded the Medal of Honor. Very close friend of mine.
Okay. And you met him at Aviano, or did you already know him?
Well, I knew him at Turner, and we went to Aviano together.
Oh, okay. Uh-huh.
Yeah.
What year was he shot down, do you know?
I don't know.
But he was a Medal of Honor winner?
Yes.
Wow.
One of few.
Air Force. Can you describe, give us a general kind of thumbnail description of this man?
He was a quiet kind of guy.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't really stand out. He did his job. I don't think he picked up on one of my additional duty recommendations, or he may have. I don't remember the details.
Uh-huh.
But he turned out to be a hero. He also ran for a senator from Minnesota, I think, unsuccessfully.
Did he really?
Yeah.
What do you know what year that was?
Oh, boy. Yes, somewhere in the... it had to be in the 70s,
huh.
mid-70s.
Wow, that's something else.
Yeah, he was a great guy.
Yeah.
What one you would not have thought to have pursued that, but after you sit in prison for 6 years and think, I guess you think being involved in the country is an important thing to do.
For sure.
I've never talked with him about it.
Not unlike John McCain.
Yep. Like. Yeah.
And is he still alive, sir?
Yes.
You know? Okay.
As a matter of fact, they did an interesting article on him out in Phoenix. I think he lives in Phoenix.
Uh-huh.
And he's in the book that's out now, the recently published book on Medal of Honor winners, which you ought to get in the library.
Yes, sir. I'll make sure that we have it. He spent 6 years?
I believe 6 years, yeah.
Have you spoken to him subsequent to?
I have not.
Okay. I
have to a number of others, however,
uh-huh.
We'll talk about later.
Sure. Were there other guys there at Aviano that you remember their backgrounds and what happened to them?
I believe he was the only one. No, Kassler was shot down, too, yeah, the one we talked about before.
In Vietnam?
The ace, yeah.
Oh, wow.
I think he was only in for a couple, 3 years. I don't recall all the details on that.
Okay, well,
It didn't have as high a profile as Thorsness did nationally.
It'd be very interesting to follow that up, though. Sounds like an excellent crew of men that you were working with there at Aviano.
They were handpicked
for that
mission.
Yeah. How long did you stay at Aviano? You said it was about a little more than 6 months.
Five and a half months.
Okay. And you then left in 1959?
Yeah.
Okay. And where did you go?
Went back to Turner Air Force Base. The wing had disbanded, and I went to the 431st Air Refueling Squadron as the adjutant executive officer.
Okay. Can you describe your duties? Were they very similar to what you had been doing?
Very much the same, perhaps a little bit expanded, because we didn't have a parent unit on base.
Mm-hmm.
We were a tenant unit, and we had to do more things. One thing particularly that I recall is I got authority from the base publications people to be able to publish our own orders, because many of the missions that the B-29 air refueling aircraft went on,
mm-hmm.
went on what we call VOCO, the verbal order of the commanding officer. We would get a request for an airplane that needed gas someplace, and he'd say, go. And then we'd have to back all that stuff up with official orders so that when the crew got back, they could get their per diem.
Right, so you had to handle...
That was one of the... I had one man that did nothing but that.
Wow.
You know, seven guys get on an airplane, and you don't know where they were before they got on the airplane, or if they're on the airplane, and you got to figure all that stuff out.
Yeah.
And then process the paperwork to get finance to pay him.
So
that was a one-man job.
Yeah, that sounds like a lot of balls in the air to document all of that.
Yeah, that's just one example.
Okay. Now, you were executive officer, correct?
Yes.
Did you have
administrative executive officer.
Okay. Uh-huh.
Nothing to do with the flying
part. Flying, right. And so you were sort of the buck stops here man for all of the
Yeah, in effect, unless it was related to flying, when the commander was gone, he was gone a lot because he liked to fly, and it was important that he do that. I was, in effect, the guy that made all of the administrative decisions.
Okay, and who was the commander there?
Benjamin F. Chapman.
Okay. He was, as you say, he was a flyer. What aircraft were assigned to the 431st?
KB-50s.
Okay. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
It was an evolution of the B-29 of World War II.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I think a minute ago I mentioned B-59 because that, or B-29,
yes.
Because that was the first aircraft they had. Then they got the modified one that was called a B-50.
And the KB.
KB 50.
Uh-huh. And the
K stands for air refueling.
Okay. Oh, it does. I didn't know that.
Yeah.
So the KB 50s in the squadron, were they difficult on maintenance?
Yeah, they were.
Okay, can you tell a little bit about that if you know?
No, because I technically don't know. I just know that maintenance was a major effort.
Okay, and did you have to like do all the paperwork to back that up as well?
No, I did not have anything to do with the maintenance.
Okay, who would take care of that kind of thing?
No, we had a major who was a maintenance officer.
Okay, so
and
so
he had a staff of 15-20 administrative people that would do that.
Okay,
I think the maintenance complement was about 350 people.
Wow,
for 24 airplanes.
That's pretty heavy.
With four engines on each airplane.
Yeah, that's pretty heavy.
Okay.
And this was all, again, just to confirm, still at Turner.
Turner Air Force Base.
Okay.
Before SAC gave it away and Strategic Air Command came in.
Okay.
With B-52s.
And what year was that that went over to SAC, do you know?
I think 60.
Okay. But you had, I gather, left by then?
Yes.
Okay.
I stayed there about 5 months, and then was assigned to Bitburg Air Base in Germany.
And would this have been 1959?
Boy, you're good on dates.
Oh.
Summer, I think July.
Okay. Your assignment over there, now this was the second time you had been to Germany. Your other posting just for a couple
of
weeks.
Yeah, just for a couple of weeks or so.
Okay. What unit were you attached to at Bitburg?
I was in the 585th Tactical Missile Group.
Okay. And
and we managed both of the air, not the ground-to-ground missiles, the only ones in the Air Force. First, the MACE, M-A-C-E, and then the Matador, M-A-T-A-D-O-R. They were on mobile launchers that we drug through the tundra. Not tundra, I guess, regular dirt and trees. Although we didn't move them that often, but we would move them. We had to guard them. One of my additional duties was to go out and set up machine guns and fields of fire and that kind of stuff. The interesting thing about the three sites that we had them at around the perimeter of Bitburg was the guidance system required multi-locations at rural areas throughout northern and eastern Germany, to which I traveled many times providing personnel guidance and assistance and doing we're here to help you, kinds of inspections and that sort of stuff.
Now, if somebody didn't know how the guidance systems worked and why it was necessary to have multiple locations, could you just run through that?
Yeah, there was no pilot. This was a missile.
Yes, sir.
But it looked like an airplane. Okay. And it had to know where to go. So we would launch it from somewhere around Bitburg, and it will be picked up and tracked by a not-too-distant communications and guidance squadron location.
Okay.
They would hand it off to another one. They would hand it off to another, and I don't know how many, depending on where the target was.
Sure.
Until the last one at the Cold War border would target it to where it was supposed to go.
Now, at each one of these control centers, about how many people were assigned there?
30 to 45.
And they were on 24-hour rotas, I
presume. Right.
And when you would go to visit the different centers, what can you detail a little bit about the kinds of things that you would work with the personnel on?
Oh, just about everything. We take a team of four or five specialists. A security guy, a cooks and baker guy to look to make sure their mess halls were all right. I looked at admin, various other things. We had a communications guy who was the primary guy to check out the operation, that sort of thing. That's the way I recall the teams were structured.
Was there a specialist with you at any time who was responsible for making sure there were no security breaches?
Oh, yeah. We took a security guy.
Okay.
In fact, one of my best friends traveled for most of the time that I was there.
Did you have any interface with that end of things, with the security checks or whatever briefings?
Yeah, I think I would accompany him on nightly visits to the outpost and that sort of thing, but I had no technical involvement in that.
Right.
But I wanted to check on the morale of the guys and that kind of stuff.
Yeah, and what observations did you make in general about these small centers?
These all were extremely well run. I don't think we replaced one commander in the 3 years that I was there.
No kidding.
Very, very capable people.
And presumably pretty darn dedicated, too. I mean, they're on 24
hours. I think the security people were. The whole missile concept was a little alien to a fighter pilot.
Mm-hmm.
Standing on the ground, launching something that you should be flying. But it was such a high profile and priority program that we had the best of the best.
And that was because it was really a frontline.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. There were only three units there.
Mm-hmm.
The 38th Tactical Missile Wing was headquartered at Sembach Air Base.
Mm-hmm.
They had a number of missiles. There were a number of missiles at Hahn, and there were a number of them at Bitburg.
And
the exact numbers I don't know and probably shouldn't tell you.
Right, okay. But from a personnel point of view, you were you didn't have very many problems with these folks. That overstating it a bit?
Yeah, I don't think. Disciplinary problems.
Right.
Lots of administrative problems.
Oh, okay.
For example,
uh-huh.
There was no promotion system or classification system as there were for most other specialties in the Air Force because it was so new.
Okay.
And so I convened a weekly classification board of two or three people,
mm-hmm.
one a technical advisor in whatever the specific specialty code was, and evaluate people to raise them from the 3 level to the 5 level to the 7 level, which were prerequisites to compete for promotion. Very, very important. And the level and quality of that that whole process was singularly important. It didn't happen anyplace else in the Air Force.
And you kind of had to basically pioneer those structures?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I was walked in, and the major said, he was my immediate boss, says, you're going to have a classification board this afternoon. And I said, yes, sir. You know, wow. I had no idea what it was, but we figured it out.
And you were still, is it accurate to say, a first lieutenant?
I was a first lieutenant when I got there and a captain about halfway in between.
Okay, so you were promoted in here somewhere.
Yeah.
Do you remember receiving your promotion?
No, it wasn't any big deal.
Okay, it was...
You knew it was going to happen. It took 7 years then.
Uh-huh. 7 years to captain?
Yep. A long time.
Wow. Yeah, that is a long time. Sounds to me like you earned it, though. This schedule for the promotions in rank for personnel in the
that was for enlisted personnel, incidentally.
Right.
Yeah.
Could you say a little bit more about the people, the enlisted personnel who were drafted into the missile units? Were there special characteristics about them that put them in that?
Yeah, area? they had to complete some really rigorous technical training.
Okay.
So they were the selection process wasn't that we took every guy on the street.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I was not involved in that, so I don't know the screening procedures.
Mm-hmm.
But I know that there was a highly selected process. We also had... We didn't have that category. But they also had to pass some pretty rigorous requirements to get a minimum secret security clearance.
Mm-hmm.
So we didn't have any bums.
Right, right.
There were management problems, yeah, sure. We probably, I don't know the numbers, but
right.
We court-martialed people and we kicked them out of the service and did that, but
yeah, for various...
not to the extent that perhaps an ordinary unit would have done.
Okay.
And they were very, very well treated. We had excellent brand new barracks, three of them in a row. One we used the main floor, the second floor, as our offices, and it was right next door to the officers' quarters, and that was neat.
Now, you were in Germany.
3 years.
3 years, 59 to...
At that time, yeah. Came back
62.
In July of 62.
Okay. Were there any particular alerts that you remember while you were there around...
I don't think we had anything other than practice alerts, and we did that maybe once every 3 months. And that was when I would go out and set up the fields of fire with a machine gun and sit in the foxhole for a day or so.
Do you remember any kind of heightened alert around the time of the Bay of Pigs operation, for example? Or does that not come to mind at all?
Well, I would have no relevance.
Okay.
Well, overall.
I mean, just
yeah,
in terms
overall
of
critical, but
yeah.
I was back in the States when that happened, and that's another story, and we can talk about that when we get to it.
Well, sure. How about now?
Okay, let's close out Bitburg.
Oh,
very,
okay.
Very rewarding experience.
Uh-huh.
Had one of the finest, highly motivated, meanest commanders in the world, Colonel Fred W. Vetter, Jr.,
mm-hmm.
who later became the secretary to the administrative secretary to the Secretary of Defense, was promoted to Brigadier General, commanded the Dover Air Force Base, retired from the Air Force, was the chief of the Delaware State Patrol, maintained a very close relationship with him. He was my mentor for a number of assignments. Passed away last August. Outstanding man, Fred W. Vetter, Jr.
Now, when General Vetter was working with the Secretary of the Air Force, do you know what years those were?
Yeah, Harold Brown's years.
Oh, okay, uh-huh.
In the, mid-60s.
Mm-hmm. Right at the...
Man, I'm not a walking historian.
That's all right, but you're doing really well. And that would be right at the time of the escalation of U.S. involvement in Southeast Asia.
Prior to that.
Okay.
He was around during the Bay of Pigs, I think. I don't know. We'd have to check.
Oh, okay. Well, we could look that up. But he was a great guy, and he was very helpful to you.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Uh huh.
A personal mentor to me.
And
I admired him.
He was. You reported to him when you were at Bitburg?
Through a major.
Okay.
But I had day to day. I was in his office half a dozen times a day. Very close relationship.
Okay. Just as a general evaluation point, what did you think of the missile systems that the Air Force had at that time?
We never knew. We took them to Tripoli once
mm-hmm.
when Gaddafi was friendlier
mm-hmm.
and fired them and had a very excellent, whatever the technical term is, but, you know, hit the target.
Right.
Or hit close to it.
Uh-huh.
And because they were nuclear tipped, you only had to hit close.
Right. That's true.
But we never fired one in vain, so we don't know.
Right.
They were very well respected as a significant part of the Western Europe defense element, which included lots of aircraft. But they were highly regarded as a part of that triad.
And were they designed specifically to take out airfields?
Yes.
Within on the eastern front there?
Yes.
Okay. Do you know how long they stayed within the Air Force inventory, the Matadors?
Yeah, I think the last one went out in 1970.
Okay, that sounds about right.
If you want to check my webpage,
mm-hmm.
all the details are there.
Okay, I will. I do have a couple pieces from the webpage, which is what's helping me navigate the dates on your many assignments. Sir, after Bitburg, where exactly did you go next?
I went to Sandia Base,
mm-hmm.
New Mexico, to the 1090th United States Air Force Special Reporting Wing that served the field command of the Defense Atomic Support Agency. Mouthful, right?
Yes, sir.
big, big operation. The entire nuclear program of the United States Multi-Service Joint Command. I was the executive officer of the American Support Unit there.
Now, by American Support Unit, what does that actually denote?
We managed all of the personnel and administrative activities of the 500 or 600 Air Force people that were stationed at Sandia, along with Army, Navy, and Marine Corps people. The base was run by the Army.
Okay, and so you oversaw personnel issues for people from the other services now as well?
No.
Okay, just Air Force people.
Air Force.
Okay, so the Air Force people at
promotion
Sandia.
Separations, the mortuary guy, the Air Force assistance guy. I had 30 additional duty titles.
30?
Yeah.
Wow. Were you trying to farm some of those out to?
No, there was nobody to farm them out to. I was the guy.
You were alone?
Yeah, I was the guy. I had a boss with a lieutenant colonel, and he wasn't going to do any of that stuff.
And you had how many people under you trying to help you with all
of
that?
Oh, a dozen.
And?
Including supply.
Okay, and supply was under you as well?
Yeah.
Wow. And you had about...
Morale, welfare, recreation, although that was run by the Army, who owned the base. Well, they didn't own it. They shared the base with the civilian company, the Sandia Corporation, if you've ever heard of that.
Yes, sir, I have.
Much in the news these days.
That's right. That's the private contractors who are running that and hooked up with Los Alamos as well.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I had to make sure that the bowling alley was working right, you know, even though I didn't run it.
Uh-huh.
And the clubs were all right, and the swimming pool worked, you know. Not as the primary guy, but I looked out to make sure it was all right for our guys.
Right.
And would share with the base commander anything that I found.
Was there any tension amongst all the different service personnel from the different
No, I don't think so. No.
Everybody got along pretty well?
Yeah.
And the focus at Sandia...
You know, the Navy guys... when they called the commissary to order steaks, they wouldn't say, "I'm Captain Smith." They'd say, "I'm Navy Captain Smith, Colonel equivalent." That's just an aside. No, I think we got along well.
And the primary business at Sandia was what exactly? You're with the Defense Atomic Support.
That's right.
What does that mean, actually? What went on there?
We ran all the tests in Nevada, Las Vegas, the Pacific. If it had to do with nuclear, whether it was on land, in the air, or at sea, it was done at Kirtland. Field Command, Defense Atomic Support Agency. Field Command is probably the unique two words to pick up.
Field Command.
Right.
Okay. And
there was the Defense Atomic Support Agency in Washington, but that was a staff level. Field Command at Sandia, Albuquerque, New Mexico, oversaw everything that happened.
And was this the group that previously was the Armed Forces Special Weapons Project?
Boy, you got your history right. Then became the Defense Nuclear Agency.
Yes, sir.
And is now part of the thing that's in trouble all the time. Whatever it is.
the DOE?
Abrahams.
Oh, right.
Department of Energy.
Yes, exactly. Yeah DOE.
Yeah.
And sir, you were at Sandia Kirtland for 1962 until when?
65.
Okay, so you were there three years.
3 years.
Okay. Let's take a break right here, sir.
Okay. All right.
This is Dr. Laura Calkins of the Vietnam Archive at Texas Tech University. I'm resuming my oral history interview with USAF Lieutenant Colonel Kay Bigger. Today's date is the 17th of February, 2004. I am in the interview room in the Special Collections Building on the campus of Texas Tech. Again, Colonel Bigger is in San Antonio. Good afternoon, sir.
Good afternoon.
Hey, we were talking about your time at Sandia.
Yes.
And that would be between 1962 and early 1965, I think.
That's correct.
Okay. And, sir, I want to ask you just a couple of questions. You had told us that you had personnel and administrative control over about 500 to 600 people at the base.
Yes, I was the executive officer of the Air Force support unit to the field command of the Defense Atomic Support Agency, which is a mouthful.
Yes, it is.
But the Army was run, the Army ran Sandia Base, and I was number two to the Lieutenant Colonel, who was in charge of all things, you know, like Air Force Deputy Base Commander kind of guy.
Okay, and this was, as you said, an Army base.
Yes.
With Air Force personnel assigned to it.
Yes.
Were there
it was co-located with an Air Force base called Kirtland Air Force Base. And it has since, Kirtland has since taken over the entire operation, and Sandia Base no longer exists as a military installation, but the Sandia National Laboratory continues to be there, and it's one of our four main national laboratories concerned now with all things scientific, not just atomic matters.
Now, when you were there, were the laboratory functions also going on Sandia Base?
Oh, very definitely, yes.
Okay, so can you give an overview of all the different kinds of personnel that were actually on the base? There was Air Force, obviously, and Army.
Air Force, Army, Navy, and some Marines, even.
Okay, there were Marines there, too.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, as well as government contract
people? Government contractors, yeah. Sandia National Laboratory at that point in time, I think, was one run by the Western Electric Corporation.
Okay, and also maybe university personnel?
Yes, I'm not sure of how that worked. I don't think there was a large direct relationship with the University of New Mexico because they weren't into those fields, but I'm sure there was some contact with whatever engineering operation the University of New Mexico had at that time.
Now, as a personnel observer and administrator, did any instances of fractious behavior amongst the different groups of people there come to your attention?
No.
Okay.
No, it was a very homogeneous arrangement. The only exciting thing we had was one time about 350 Peace Corps students came through there. I had some extra building space, and we offered that up for them to stay a couple, three nights. And boy, what a rowdy crowd that was.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Now, what happened? Do you remember?
Oh, I think a lot. I don't know if there were any actual arrests, but a lot of drunk and disorderly kinds of things. They did have a staff that took care of that, so I didn't get personally involved going to the drunk tank to pick them up. But my people arranged to get them showered down and to bed, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Now, not to denigrate the Peace Corps, but they were certainly different than military people.
And were they basically just having a good time that got a little bit out of hand, or was there something else?
Yeah, I think they were on their way to overseas assignments, and it was their last chance to party in the United States. So
it was
understandable.
Last hurrah kind
of
thing. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. And sir, in general, the work of the base had to do with atomic weaponry.
Yes, the Sandia base exclusively, and then the Air Force Special Weapons Center just down the runway on Kirtland Air Force Base was very heavily involved in Air Force aspects of nuclear power.
Okay. Now, did the recent test ban that had been agreed between the United States and Soviet Union have any appreciable effect on activities there while you were there?
No. As a matter of fact, we had some very major testing activities that were done both in Nevada and in the Pacific. And at one point in time, we had a very high-level joint task force come in for a short stay. They were to have been quartered in my facility, but didn't actually work out. But that was a high-level effort during those periods of time.
Now, was that group of people that might have or was initially scheduled to come out to see you, were those Department of Defense people?
Yes.
Okay.
Headed by whatever we call it today, but two-star equivalent civilian people, high connections.
Sir, while you were there, the President of the United States was assassinated.
That's right. I can tell you a little bit about that.
That would be great.
In my role of serving as the liaison between the Air Force element at Sandia Base and the local community, I was at a police officer function. I think we had a luncheon and coordinated different things during the course of that.
Mm-hmm.
And it was announced at that meeting that the president had been killed. And the meeting immediately broke up, and we went to see if we were into an active military posture, which we weren't.
Mm-hmm.
A same similar circumstance happened during the Cuban crisis, at which, when I returned to base, we were on high alert.
Mm-hmm.
So just a couple little vignettes.
Now, you said that the that there was no alert after the assassination?
Yes.
Okay.
I'm sure that some elements of the military were put into a higher alert status, but there was no overall worldwide alert status declared, to the best of my recollection.
Okay, and no particular effects on you there at Sandia?
No.
Okay. But during the Cuban Missile Crisis, there had been.
Yes.
Okay. Since I think we skipped over that, could you just mention a little bit more about where you were and how that affected the people that you were working with at the time?
Well, I think in order to be ready to react to the worst possible scenario, we all packed up dozens of trucks and went far south into the desert and set up camp and simulated the combat conditions over a three-day period of time. That was a very exciting and interesting experience, but one I'd probably not want to go through again.
And that's because you were, like everyone, very nervous, sir?
Well, I think so, yeah, the whole country was.
Absolutely, yes. Now, sir, after you left Sandia, your next assignment was what?
The Air Weather Service at Scott Air Force Base in Illinois.
Okay.
Let me tell you just a little. No, you've got your questions.
Oh, well, no, you go right ahead, and then I'll
let me give you a quick overview.
Sure.
That was the headquarters of the Worldwide Air Weather Service. We had about six wings around the world, one in the Pacific, one in Europe, one at SAC headquarters, one at TAC headquarters, et cetera, to administer the 12 to 15 and or more Weather Service people that were at every Air Force installation in the world. So a pretty far-flung operation. And in addition to being the commander of the headquarters squadron there, I also functioned in a number of roles in personnel, probably the major one in charge of airmen assignments, where I had some 14,000 weather observers and forecasters that we managed assignments, travel, and all of that from all those far-flung places. Rather interesting job, nothing really exciting, very important day-to-day work, but probably not a lot to talk about.
Well, sir, just let me ask you one or two questions about it. The 14,000 observers, now, are those all people within the military structure? Are they
Yes, enlisted people.
Okay. And did they have any particular special training?
Oh, yes, okay. Very extensive.
Can you talk a little bit about that, the training process that those people went through?
Oh, I think it was a minimum of like 6 months at the Air Force technical schools. I think one of the schools was just outside of Chicago at Rantoul, Illinois. The base is closed now, and my Alzheimer's don't give me an instant recollection of what it was. Chanute Air Force Base. All of the officers in Air Weather Service had college degrees in whatever they may have had one, but then also additionally in weather.
Okay.
And many of them went to school at the world's premier weather university, the University of Washington, my home state of Washington, I'm proud
yes,
to say.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. And the personnel that you were managing over this very broad network, can you describe what it was that you were actually doing? Were you promoting people within, looking for people who might rise to higher levels of responsibility, managing?
Not technically involved in the promotion process because that was an Air Force-wide program. But I had a very key role in determining which people would be promoted by monitoring the officer and airman effectiveness reports rendered on them. Now, I didn't write them, but I reviewed them to make sure that they were adequate and sent to lots of people's dismay down the line, many of them back for rewrites.
Okay, because they didn't conform to a particular style, or because they were missing content, or what kinds of?
Missing content and typographical errors too.
We
were very, very restrictive in those programs throughout the Air Force to make sure that we gave our people proper recognition for the jobs that they did.
Sir, was the weather data that the Air Force was generating and that the people that you were overseeing generated, was that shared in any way with other branches of the service?
Yeah, with the Weather Service, the National Weather Service in particular, and we had, have you ever heard of the Hurricane Hunters?
Yes, sir.
The people that fly into the heart of the hurricane?
Mm-hmm.
Those were our guys.
Really?
Yep.
Okay.
Stationed out of... I believe at that time, Mississippi, Keesler Air Force Base.
Okay. And so there was sharing with other branches of the military as well? Or did each branch have its own?
I think there was some sharing, but probably the highest level of sharing was with the National Weather Service.
Okay. Okay, so civilian information.
Right.
Okay. Sir, where would you say that the Air Weather Service ranked in terms of Air Force priorities? Was this service given appropriate resources?
We were actually at that time our parent command, co-located on that Scott Air Force Base, was the Military Airlift Command.
Okay.
And we were subordinate to it.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, I think we rated high priority and had all of the resources that were necessary. I was responsible for the $800,000 headquarters building and maintenance and et cetera of that. I didn't actually sweep the floors, but,
but
on occasion I'd pick up a newspaper or a paper gum wrapper.
I was going to say candy wrapper. Sir, at this point, now you were there from, I think, 1965 until the end of 67. Is that correct?
Till the middle of, I think I went on my first training, which we're going to talk about in a minute, and departed there probably in September. And maybe had a little leave or something.
Okay.
But I think we're probably ready with one more thing.
Okay.
I guess I was picked for this special assignment because of my overall general background, but I became overnight an international political military affairs officer. And I didn't even know how to spell that.
How was that accomplished, sir?
Well, that's the kind of billet that they had in Saigon that I was going to fill after I went through this training that we're going to talk about.
Okay. Well, when did you find out that you were going to be leaving Scott and going on a special training mission?
I think much to my wife's dismay, probably about July.
Okay.
And she was, of course, you know, like everyone, not overly happy with that, but that's what I did for a living.
Mm-hmm. Now, you mean her finding out that you're
going to
likely,
Vietnam to war.
Yes, that you're likely assignment.
Yeah, particularly when she found out I was going to be on the ground in Vietnam, not as many other Air Force people who were away from the scene, but supporting it from Thailand and other places.
Now you handled that by basically just saying this is my next assignment and that's how it's going to look.
When I was told to march, I marched.
Okay, and where did you march to?
I marched to first to Hurlburt Field of Eglin Air Force Base, which is the home of the Air Force Special Operations. The commandos of the Air Force.
Mm-hmm. And how long were you there?
That was just a two-week course, but it was very intensive and gave me a tremendous outlook at what the combat capabilities of the Air Force were.
Okay.
Many air power demonstrations, lots of theory and on counterinsurgency and what it's all about,
mm-hmm.
how to fight it, the same kind of thing that we're facing in Iraq today. And even though we were doing it back then, we're ill-prepared.
Mm-hmm. So that two-week course gave way to what?
To going to the United States Army John F. Kennedy Special Warfare Center and School
mm-hmm.
at Fort Bragg, North Carolina.
And how long were you there, sir?
6 weeks.
Okay.
Playing like a Green Beret.
Were you really out in the field doing mock-ups?
Yeah,
and...
yeah, and Army exercises. An hour a day.
Okay, and what
running
else?
Miles and miles and miles.
They worked you hard?
Yeah.
What kind of...
I wasn't really prepared for that.
Well, I was going to ask you what kind of shape you were in,
a
sir.
A desk jockey, yeah.
Yeah, uh-huh. Was it tough?
It was tough, yeah.
I believe it. What else did they have you learning there?
A lot of things about the nature of the war, that it was not a civil war, the Tonkin Gulf incident. It was a psychological preparation thing in large part.
Mm-hmm.
Not much at all about what I would actually be doing when I got to Vietnam.
But they were in effect.
Except to know that, you know, I may have been, and I was on occasion, out in the middle of it with the Green Berets at the A-teams. That was not my regular job.
No, sir.
But some of the guys that went through that course, that was their job.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, one of my closest buddies, a Navy lieutenant commander, about a week or two after I got to Saigon, called me from the hospital, and he just came back severely wounded from a Green Beret A-team camp.
After having just been out there that short time?
Yeah, just a couple of weeks.
Yeah. So this was an all-services school?
Correct.
Okay.
No Marines.
No Marines.
No Marines.
Why was that, do you know?
Well, Marines had their own thing going.
Okay.
And when we talk about Vietnam, I'll tell you about the Marines.
Okay, great. The instructors at the JFK school, do you remember any of them particularly?
Yeah, primarily Army guys,
mm-hmm.
Green Beret kinds of guys, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And most of them, I'm assuming at this point, had been over to Vietnam.
I think probably so. I never ever asked that question, but
okay. Yeah,
my general impression was that they were seasoned veterans.
And they were trying to get across to you was more sort of the history and the intricacy of the conflict in which the U.S. was involved?
That's right.
Okay, as opposed to
battlefield tactics mm-hmm. and that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm. And what was the general, if you remember at all, the sort of rank level of the other people in the class?
Majors and lieutenant colonels.
Okay, at this point you were a major, is that right?
Yes.
Okay, because you had been promoted when you were at the Air Weather Service, is that
yes,
right?
Yes, that's correct. Boy, you're okay. Perceptive.
Well, or well informed, I think. I had an informant. That would be you.
Okay.
So I studied anyway what you sent. And I, just for the sake of the interview, want the listeners to be clear that at this point you were a major, and that was pretty standard rank among the others in the classes.
In the classes, but far more than the average rank of the officer in Vietnam. And we'll get more into that when I tell you what the level of my duties in Vietnam were.
Okay. Yes, because I think they seem to have been quite important duties. You were at Fort Bragg then for about 6 weeks, you said?
Yeah.
Okay, and did you have a little leave before you were actually...
Yeah, short leave, 3 days. I left the day before Christmas.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Only 3 days leave.
Yeah.
Do you remember what you did, sir?
Kind of helped to get my wife settled, although she was already settled. And
now, where was she
enjoyed
going to be,
the 3 days.
Where was she going to be living while you
she
were
stayed
gone?
In Albuquerque.
Okay. And did you own a home out there?
Or at one time we did, but she lived in a high-rise apartment during the time I was in Vietnam.
Okay. Now, did you have an agreement with her as to her not worrying or something like that while you were gone?
Oh, I don't know if there's anything specific like that.
Okay.
She was adjusted to, you know, the military. And
Now, did you set up any kind of an arrangement about writing back and forth or any of that?
Oh, yeah. We corresponded regularly.
Okay.
And I sent photographs.
Okay.
Some of which you have.
Yes, sir. I have them actually in front of me.
The one thing that we,
a few of them, anyway.
One thing we threw away when Vietnam wasn't a very popular topic was my daily correspondence, which would have been interesting to still have, but
yes.
I don't, unfortunately.
Okay. Okay. Yes, that's a shame. But maybe we can reconstruct some of the events anyway here in the course of this interview.
Yeah, I think so.
Sir, you said you left on the 24th of December. What was your route over to Vietnam?
It was to Travis Air Force Base, where I was supposed to take some weapons training, but I had already had much more extensive weapons training at Fort Bragg, and I had a letter to say that was waived.
Okay. So you continued on through then?
Yeah. Travis Air Force Base all the way to Tan Son Nhut Air Base. No, we stopped in the Philippines.
Okay.
Stopped in the Philippines.
Did you stay on the plane or get off?
I got off, but got back on again. It was not an overnight stay.
Okay. When you arrived at Tan Son Nhut, was it nighttime or
it
day?
It was... Yeah, I think it was nighttime just before dawn breaking because it was a kind of a eerie feeling. They took away all my American money and gave me whatever piastres, the Vietnamese version of currency, because we weren't supposed to have any dollars because of black market kind of stuff.
Okay.
Put us in a bus and took us to a billet hotel processing center in Cholon, just outside of downtown Saigon.
Yes, the Chinese area.
Yeah, hey, you know.
Yes, that's right.
Well, one look at that place, and I said, I don't want any of this. I'm a big boy, and so I got me one of those little yellow and blue, not Peugeot, whatever the other French car name
Renault?
Is.
Renault?
Huh?
A Renault?
Renault, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Taxis. And went directly to the Rex Hotel in the downtown center of Saigon and walked in and said, I'm here, give me a room. And they quickly told me it doesn't work that way.
Oh, really?
And they told me where to go about 3 blocks down the street, which was the billeting office. And I think I had the foresight to have the cabbie wait.
Very good.
And so, you know, because I had 500 pounds of luggage or whatever. Not that much, but a hell of a lot of stuff.
Now, what were you bringing over there?
Lots of fatigues, clothes, personal effects, my tape recorder, and other personal items that I wanted to have. I think I had four bags and a briefcase.
Okay. Yeah, that's
so he took me down to this other place, and I got out, and while I was fumbling around to pay him, I dropped my ID card and didn't realize it, and so I was walking a little bit further down the street to go to this billeting office, and this guy comes running after me, and I thought, oh, my God, what's going on?
Mm-hmm.
You know, that was a kind of a scary moment at that point in time after no sleep for 24 hours and being in a strange land, et cetera, et cetera. But so on for that. He was bringing me my ID card, and that was typical of the Vietnamese, for the most part, were very, very happy that we were there and were very cooperative.
So you went in and got some sleep, I assume.
No, I went in and they said, okay, we're going to put you in the tax building, which is a commercial building and also the government tax office, right across the street from the Rex Hotel. So it was really pretty nice as far as location and that sort of thing. The rooms were crummy. I originally shared a room with an Australian lieutenant colonel. And about 2 or 3 days later, I found out that there was another guy that had a private room, and he wasn't in it. No, it was a room for two, but he wasn't in it because he stayed someplace else because of his duty.
Okay.
And I talked him into letting me have that room. So
okay.
Essentially, I had a private little room with a refrigerator and a toilet,
mm-hmm.
actually,
mm-hmm.
and two beds and an air conditioner that didn't work.
Oops.
On the second floor of the tax building, which housed a discotheque that played loud music, but they did shut it off at 9 o'clock directly at night.
Oh, well, I bet you were thankful for that.
Yeah.
Sir, did you have orders to MACV headquarters at that
time? Yes, I did.
Okay.
But
mm-hmm, go ahead.
That, we'll talk about that. But I was an advisor in MACV headquarters. But there's much more to talk about.
Okay. Well, you can go ahead and lead us on if you want to.
Okay. Acclimation, I guess I went to that two-day orientation thing by taxi from my tax quarter billet.
Mm-hmm. Now, where was that held?
Pardon me?
Where was that?
That was back in Sholon.
Okay. Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Okay.
My daily routine began by catching a shuttle bus just outside my building and going to where I worked, which was USAID 2 headquarters office building, and I'll tell you more about that later.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Probably it's the time to talk about that.
Okay, go ahead. That'd be great.
While I was assigned technically to MACV, Military Assistance Command Vietnam headquarters, I worked with USAID, the United States Agency for International Development People.
Okay.
State Department People,
mm-hmm.
and Office of the Special Assistant People, codename CIA.
Got it. Mm-hmm.
Worked in this three-story, pretty good shape office building in kind of a residential area. In fact, the front entrance to it was beautiful. You've got pictures of that.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir.
And hardly anyone ever went in there. It was a very serene operation. But the back end of that thing was a madhouse. It was the motor pool and the operations and all of that. And strangely enough, on one side of it was the pagoda that you've got a picture of.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, so it was an interesting thing.
Huh. Uh-huh. Did you have anything to do with the back end operations where things were so busy back there?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Air America was back there, and we'll talk uh-huh. more about Air America
sure.
later.
Okay, I'm making a list.
And that was where I came in and had my ham and egg sandwich and went to work.
Okay.
Ham and egg sandwich and a little lean-to, canvas-covered makeshift thing.
And did you get that on the street, sir, or where'd you get the food?
No, it was in this compound in the rear of
USAID
2 headquarters. Uh-huh.
And in the USAID 2 building, were there any other groups who had their HQ there?
Yes, and I'll go into that.
Okay.
It was the brain center of everything that happened in Vietnam except military operations. Now, military operations also had some people that worked in the pacification area
mm-hmm.
that we'll talk more about. They were called Combined Action Platoons. And up in I Corps, the northern provinces where the Marines held stay, and we'll talk more about that,
mm-hmm.
they had similar operations. But I was in the plans and programs division of headquarters MACV, civil operations and revolutionary development support division, working for a guy named Clay McManaway, who is the senior civilian in the Cords operation. He later became ambassador to Haiti and apparently didn't do too good a job with what's going on down there now.
When was he the ambassador, sir? Do you know?
I don't know. Back
in the 80s?
I think in the 80s or mm-hmm. whenever it was that we were in there and cleaned the place up. I think he was in charge of that.
Okay.
And then we left and it went downhill.
Okay, yes.
But that's another story.
Yes, sir.
But he was a bright sort of guy. He worked directly for Ambassadors Comer
mm-hmm.
and Colby. And you know who they are.
Well, that would be Robert Comer.
That's right. The guy, the dynamite guy that went over there and really started all of the pacification and the revolutionary development support work.
And Bill Colby.
Bill Colby, who became the director of Central Intelligence Agency and took much of the heat for what went on over there, particularly the Phoenix program, which I'll talk to you in detail about.
Okay, super. Now, tell me about McManoway's background. Do you know anything about where he went to school, where he was from, or other postings?
Gee, I read his bio years ago. Mm-hmm. I think he was from somewhere in the South, North or South Dakota or something.
Okay.
Had served, I think, 2 years in the Army and then went into relatively high-level civil service and wound up where he was as this kind of guy and then an ambassador.
Okay.
So obviously a very, very talented kind of guy.
Now, Kay, did you report directly to him?
No, I reported to a guy named Larry Marinelli.
How do you spell his last name?
Marinelli.
Okay.
He was a reserve civil servant. I'm trying to think what they call them. State Department kind of guy.
Okay.
Okay.
And
very, very brilliant.
Uh-huh.
Very brilliant. I had no problem in working for that young 29 because he was so sharp and because he turned over almost all of his operation to me to look after for him.
Uh-huh. Are you still there, sir?
Yes.
Oh, okay, good.
He was in charge of the 25 to 30 man operation in plans and programs for CORDS at the USAID 2 building.
Okay. And did McManoway also work in USAID 2?
No, he worked at the headquarters, MACV at Tansanute Air Base.
Okay.
Where I traveled back and forth daily. And we'll talk more about that.
Okay. Now, can you describe your brief? What was it that you were actually assigned to do?
Okay. I was the only Air Force officer in CORDS.
Mm-hmm.
There were in my in Marinelli's unit two Army lieutenant colonels and a major who were primarily involved in money things, funding.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Putting together budgets and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
Marinelli looked at my background and saw that I had been a division chief at Scott Air Force Base, and that meant far more to him than it probably really should have meant. But it was fortunate for me that that caught his eye, and he said, I want you to take over this 25 to 30 person conglomerate that nobody knows what the other guy's doing and make it work.
Okay.
And that was right up my alley, so I mm-hmm. did that.
Mm-hmm.
And started reading all the correspondence, handing out the tasking assignments to the civilians, organized the three secretaries into a secretarial pool,
mm-hmm.
Brought the three non-commissioned officers together, and made them show up for work and do stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
They were a unique bunch. Sergeant Barry, who was a senior guy, was the typical Army sergeant that can get anything anywhere as long as he gets it at night.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
One of the other kids was named Durbro. His father had been a previous ambassador to Vietnam, and he was very helpful in the fact that he grew up as a kid in Vietnam, in Saigon,
mm-hmm.
and knew every street and every back alley that there was.
And overall, what was this group of about 30 people? What was their function? What were they actually doing?
They were plans and programs officers
mm-hmm.
to direct tasking and guidance in these areas: public relations, public safety, psychological operations, Chuhoy, which we'll talk more about.
Mm-hmm.
You know how to spell that?
Yes, go ahead, sir, though.
C-H-I-E-U, H-O-I, yes. Capital H-O-I.
Yes, sir. Mm-hmm.
The Revolutionary Development Cadre. Did I say public safety and public relations?
Yes, you did.
Okay, and then probably most importantly, the Phoenix program, and you know what that is.
Yeah, yes, and you'll tell us a little bit more about that, too. And so you had this staff that you were in charge of sort of making run.
The administrative guy, yeah.
Okay, uh-huh, you were making them run just like you had done in a previous assignment.
Right.
Okay.
And I had two guys that were part of that group, mm-hmm. but that served most of their time out in the field, living in the Vietnamese villages as our kind of eyes and ears mm-hmm. to give us feedback as to what the programs that we were developing and having other people implement were doing. So that was, you know, they'd come in and say, hey, this doesn't work.
Okay.
Change it.
Okay. You know? Were they assigned to a particular core area?
Yeah, they were. I think they were both in three corps. Mm-hmm. But in two separate villages, and I would go out occasionally and spend some time with them.
Okay. Can you tell us their names?
Yeah.
Okay.
One was named Shipley, mm-hmm. and his father was a senior executive in AP, Associated Press.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
The other one was Frank Bigelow of the Bigelow Carpet.
Oh.
Dynasty.
Mm-hmm.
These were the kinds of caliber of guys that we had.
And it sounds like a pretty sharp team.
Yeah, it was, very.
Okay. And was it basically a stationary team in terms of personnel over the time you were
yeah,
there?
Yeah, over the period, well, I was only there for a year. But yeah, I don't think we had many changes.
Okay.
A couple of guys came in during that period of time, yeah.
Okay. Now, can you speak for just a moment about the sort of structural relationship between plans and programs and the rest of CORDS?
Yeah.
Okay.
We put together what to do, and not that we were powerful, told them what to do, and they carried it out. For example, in public safety, just to give you a caliber there, the head guy in public safety was the former chief of police of New York City.
Who was that?
Can't think of his name right now.
Okay.
An Italian name, but it doesn't
uh-huh.
come.
Okay.
And he must have had 100 retired policemen or police types that worked for him
uh-huh.
in advising the Vietnamese police department on what to do on a daily basis.
Okay.
So we told them, you know, what it was that Commander McVie wanted them to do, and they went and did it. I didn't do that, although for about a week, I worked in a Saigon city hall right after Tet.
Okay. I'll ask you about that, too, because,
yeah.
of course, Tet
figures, Tet's going to take a few minutes.
Yeah, it figures largely in your experience over there. But it's interesting to hear the relationship between the group that you were with and the rest of CORDS. So you were, in fact, kind of making up...
I was a go-between guy.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. And,
I also served as a part-time executive officer to the number two civilian. He was the number one civilian in the CORDS 2 setup.
Which was who?
Good thinking. Maynard. Leonard Maynard.
Okay.
He was a general officer equivalent. Gave me a nice write-up.
Okay. And you performed sort of administrative...
I was the go-to guy.
Mm-hmm.
If anybody needed to have a piece of paper coordinated, they knew to go see that Air Force major in plans and programs because he's easy.
And he could make it happen.
Yeah, or okay. I could make it not happen.
Oh, okay. Make things go away.
Yeah, I could send them back and they would have to redo it.
Okay.
I didn't always rely just on my judgment, although I had a pretty good feel for everything that was going on,
mm-hmm.
but I'd grab one of my guys who was the expert in that area and say, hey, look at this and tell me if we ought to hack off on it or not.
Okay, right. Now, you mentioned, Kay, also that another area within plans and programs was public relations. Can you talk about the general...
We didn't do much in that area
mm-hmm.
because that was a province of Just Pow. Have you ever heard of that?
Yes.
Joint United Research State's Public Affairs Office.
Mm-hmm.
The guys that conducted the 5 o'clock follies. Do you know what that's all about?
Oh, yeah. Go ahead and tell us those.
Yeah, I had a buddy in that, and I used to go to those occasionally.
Now, for somebody who didn't get that reference, what is that?
Well, that was a briefing at 5 o'clock every evening on the front steps of the Just POW headquarters, which were probably the most ingrained, uncontrolled group in Vietnam. They did their thing the way they wanted to do it.
And did it bear much relationship to reality, would you say?
That's a question in most everybody's mind.
Okay.
But the thrust of the 5 o'clock follies was the body count, which was one of the biggest mistakes we ever made.
Why do you say that, sir?
Well, because it didn't mean anything.
Okay.
There were so many bodies that if we kill 14,000 a day, you know, the war would never be over.
Kind of a false indicator, you would say?
False indicator, yeah, because a lot of people we were killing, as comes out in the Phoenix program, weren't enemy combatants.
Okay. Now, what about...
I better be careful about that.
Oh, no, I think it's a lot of it's been, you know, revealed at this point in the secondary literature.
Okay.
But, you know, only say what you're comfortable with saying. And you know that. Now, the PSYOPs part of plans and programs, what was that about?
Can I take just a quick break?
Sure.
A guy brought in. Okay.
There you go. Sir, I had asked you in general terms about the PSYOPs work and what that looked like. What was the general parameters of that work?
That was dropping leaflets and aircraft that flew constantly over the entire, well, not the entire, but major population centers, broadcasting propaganda, if you want to call it that, psychological operations, but to tell them to, you know, don't consort with the Viet Cong and cooperate with the government.
Now, these programs that you've talked about, advising the police, some PR work, PSYOPs, were those sort of fully fledged programs by the time you were assigned in Saigon?
Oh, no, this was all relatively new.
Okay, it was taking shape.
It had been going on in a very piecemeal fashion, but it was just pulled together shortly before I got there, maybe 6 months.
Okay, because CORDS itself had just kind of begun to gel.
It came into existence in May of 67, I believe, on paper.
Right.
And then it took a while to pull all of the disparate elements together, and I guess we never had them pulled together until we left.
Well, it sounds like you were at the forefront anyway of that.
I was in the middle of it. I was not a big deal.
Okay, well.
But I was. Majors and lieutenant colonels were something that people listened to.
Sure, that's right. As you say, that was pretty high in the pecking order in terms of people deployed on the ground over there. Sir, can you describe the Chu Hoi?
Just a minute.
Oh,
excuse me, just a minute.
Sure. Yep. I was asking if you could describe the Chu Hoi program.
Yeah, Chu Hoi program were the people that came over from the other side, and we tried to re-indoctrinate them.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of positive aspects of that, a lot of negative publicity about the people that we had in the underground prisons.
Can you talk a little bit more about the positive aspects to it?
I think, Laura, I'm going to have to call you.
Now, sir, I was asking you about the Plans and Programs Office, and specifically if you had a general overview that you could offer of the Chu Hoi program, and you told us that that was primarily about people turning themselves in and that it had some positive aspects to it, although it got bad publicity.
Yeah, it was a repatriation effort that, for the most part, was very successful. There were a lot of them that went back again to the other side under pressure, but we did get some good people to come with us, and we did have that one, maybe more, but at least that one bad aspect of the pictures that the newspaper got out of the people in the underground cages with the bars over the top and how they threw them the food, you know, that bad stuff.
Right.
That probably happened.
Do you know whether it happened or not? Do you recall any?
I have no personal knowledge.
Mm-hmm. And did you get a sense or, in fact, intelligence at any point that Chuhoy program was being sort of double-played, if you will, by BC or NDA defectors, that they were coming into the program under the guise of turning themselves in? Do you know anything about
that? I had no personal knowledge of that,
mm-hmm.
but I'm sure that happened.
Okay. And, sir, can you tell us a little bit about the
Well, you know a lot about Vietnam.
Well, I'm supposed to. That's
That's
my job, but I don't know everything, that's for darn sure. And I know that you know things I don't know. I just have to get to them. So, for example, maybe you know some things that aren't generally known about the RD cadre program.
I did not get that deeply involved in that.
Okay.
Except to know that the Revolutionary Development Support people were called, there were two parts of that,
mm-hmm.
the RF and the PF. Have you heard of that?
Yes. Go ahead.
Regional forces mm-hmm. and
provincial
forces.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. No, I think I did visit a base camp of them once, but it was for a very brief time, and I don't think I've got any special insight into that. You probably have more generalized information than I do.
With each of the programs that were within the plans and programs grouping, were there particular subheads who were administratively responsible for that group, and then they reported to you?
Oh, yeah. We had
okay.
one of our 25-member staff, or two,
uh-huh.
that were specialists in each of these areas.
Okay. Now, you mentioned the police chief, I think, from New York.
Yeah.
He was in charge of the public safety area.
Right.
Do you remember some of the other sort of, if you want, program heads?
Not that I've got anything like I could say, you know, the guy was the former district attorney,
mm-hmm.
you know, that sort
right.
of thing.
Right.
The example of the police chief,
mm-hmm.
to my knowledge, I don't know another name, or well, I didn't even know his name, or I knew it, but I can't remember.
Can't recall
now.
It, yeah. Uh-huh.
But they were people of that caliber. These were not mm-hmm. guys off the street. These were people that headed up each of these areas. With very outstanding professional qualifications,
mm-hmm.
although at this stage, much of this stuff was preliminary and nobody was an expert in anything.
Right, because you were all just kind of inventing it as you went
yeah,
along.
Yeah, that's right.
Uh-huh. Yeah. And how much...
But, you know, based on things that had happened before, but mm-hmm. never to the extent that
right.
This revolution, civil operations and revolutionary development support effort, as we talked about, was spearheaded by Comer, then taken over by Colby,
mm-hmm.
and was a very, very major part, and probably the thing that would have worked in Vietnam if we'd had a chance to let it go.
Mm-hmm. But the program was getting interrupted by military operations, particularly by Tet.
Yes.
Okay.
Oh, yeah. Tet
mm-hmm.
threw us for a loop, but we were the ones that made Tet recovery, and I'll tell you what I did in my small way to make that work.
Yes, sir. Well, let's go ahead and consider that.
Let me tell you just a little bit
sure.
more about the operations, just so you can see, you know, my little role in it.
That'll be great. Yeah.
I served on the general, the RVN, the Republic of Vietnam General Mobilization Staff, as an advisor to that Vietnamese group.
Okay.
I served on the Delta Transportation Committee.
Mm-hmm.
I also served as a Corps liaison to Air America. So you can see I had many hats and did lots of stuff, but, you know, not as a runner, but as a coordinator.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Keeping things flowing.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Now,
And after I got the office pretty well organized, my stature seemed to go up from riding around in my three guys' stolen Jeep, I'm sure it was stolen, to getting an International Harvester SUV that day, to then getting a staff car and a driver. So my standing logistically
mm-hmm.
elevated considerably
mm-hmm.
in my first month or so there, for whatever that's worth.
And
that leads me to the other point.
Okay.
I would go at least once a day from
mm-hmm.
USAID to headquarters in downtown Saigon out to MACV headquarters at Tan Son Nhut, usually late in the day, mm-hmm. to take all of the work that had been done by the staff that day, staff studies, paper for the general, papers for the ambassador, and go up and in many instances walk those through for coordination with the major elements of the MACV staff. So I had a pretty good understanding of who the players were.
Because you were actually over there every day, more or less.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And while I met, I think, once very briefly with Comer and a couple, three times with Colby, I usually would wind up dumping my stuff at the lap of their exec, General, good old, what's his name?
Forsyth?
One-star general. I'll think of it.
Okay. I didn't quite have that to hand, unfortunately.
I did have that level of contact.
Mm-hmm.
I also read everything message traffic wise that went in and out every day from headquarters MACV, wherever it was around the country, and had access to the back channel traffic from General Westmoreland and the ambassador.
By back channel traffic, you mean
that
traffic.
Stuff nobody reads but mm-hmm. them and the president.
Okay.
Or whoever the president might decide he wanted to read it.
That was material going to and from D.C. then?
Yes.
Okay.
And occasionally to the ambassadors in Laos, Cambodia, and Thailand.
Okay. And I would imagine that all that traffic picked up considerably at the end of January and then into February of 1968.
Yeah, and that was a couple of weeks that I was away from it.
Okay.
I don't know that it picked up that much, that heavy. It was heavy.
Okay. Uh-huh.
It would take me 4 hours every morning to read that stuff.
Really?
Yeah, and to decide what I needed to do with something that may have pertained to us.
And I assume, the principal purpose for your monitoring all this?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Right.
Was to see programmatic implications?
Right.
Okay. And what time did you get to work in the morning?
Usually at before 7.
Okay, okay.
Then we would break at 11:30 till 2, Vietnamese style,
mm-hmm.
for whatever they call that.
Okay.
And then we would come back and work till 8, 9, 10 o'clock at night.
Okay. So you were pretty busy day after day with all...
Oh, yeah, 7 days a week.
Okay.
You know, once in a while, old Larry would say, hey, go take the afternoon off, or, you know, mm-hmm. take a day off. Don't come in tomorrow.
But in general,
not very often.
Yeah, in general, you were...
War.
You had your foot down. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Sir, where were you when the Tet Offensive began? And how
I was under my bed.
I was going to say, how did you find out about it?
Yeah.
What happened?
Rockets.
Okay.
That landed very near my room. None, mm-hmm. no fragments, nothing hit. I was all right, but I was under that bed.
Now, this is in the tax building?
Tax building, yeah. Second floor.
Do you know what the date was?
Yeah, what was the date of Tet? The 31st of January, 1968.
Okay, so you...
The real Tet.
You,
Tet came every year.
Yes, that's right. This is the last day of Tet, in fact, the 31st of January, the last day of the festival. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, when we were supposed to have had all mutually agreed upon ceasefires.
Right.
That only the United States honored.
That's right. And what was the city like that
okay,
morning?
You've got pictures.
Yes, sir. Mm-hmm.
The front of the tax building, you had to walk around bodies, step by step, because they were all living there 24 hours a day, cooking, sleeping, eating, and selling black market goods.
Mm-hmm.
Wall to wall, sidewalk full,
mm-hmm.
every day, 24 hours a day, until Tet. Look at those pictures. The streets are empty, completely empty, with exception of a rolled-up newspaper here or there.
Mm-hmm.
Dramatic, dramatic.
Was there any warning at all, sir? Was there any rumblings the night before that you remember, or people getting out of the street, or any of that?
Not that I remember.
Okay.
I'm mm-hmm. sure MACV and General Wyand, who was in charge of the three-corps forces, brought in a number of people from the Cambodian border and had them take up positions around Saigon, because he alone was probably the only guy that paid any attention to the intelligence and did that. Had he not have done that, things would have turned out much, much different mm-hmm. in my personal and in many people's professional viewpoints.
Yes, yes, sir. And he had brought some forces into town. Were they in evidence, at least in your travels?
No. The initial reaction, mm-hmm. The night of Saigon, and I had been at a party at the embassy mm-hmm. earlier that evening, coincidentally.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh. What was that party?
And there
party
was no
about?
Visible different kind of security than the little white mice, which we call laughingly the Vietnamese police, mm-hmm. wore white shirts, mm-hmm. Of the American Army military police, who did most of the fighting in the initial hours at 3 o'clock in the morning.
Right.
And were responsible for taking the embassy back.
So that evening, everything seemed fine.
Yeah, yeah, it was a normal evening. Mm-hmm. You know, at that time, this was pretty good duty. It was,
yes, sir.
You know, not a nice place to be and not away from home. But you know, I used to go to the International Club and have dinner and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm. And the party that night. Do you remember what it was? What the occasion was? Was it because of Tet?
No, I don't think so. I think it was a birthday or something, mm-hmm. maybe even for the guy. Yeah, maybe it was his birthday. The guy that shot the Vietnamese, Colonel...
Guan, the head of the police?
No. American retired uh-huh. colonel who was the uh-huh. chancery head in the embassy. Another name I can't remember right off hand.
That's okay. But it may have been a party around that kind of occasion then, for a birthday or something.
Yeah, more than it was in celebration of Tet.
Okay. And you just went home as you normally would after?
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah, about 10 o'clock.
Okay. And that morning, early that morning, you heard the rockets and you scrambled under the bed.
About 3 o'clock in the morning.
Okay. And how long did you stay in the room?
I stayed in the room, I think, until midday, when there was an army colonel who was kind of, I've never met him until then,
mm-hmm.
but he was kind of, you know, the building head guy, or the ranking guy in the building.
Okay. And he
sort of came around and knocked on all our doors and, had a roster that we put for security. We were not secured in the tax building by any MPs or anything of that sort. We did have a gated front door we locked at night, but mm-hmm. anybody could have broken into that. But he put us all on guard duty, and I think we had three M-17s, which were a larger rifle than the M-16. And we would trade those. We all had 45s or whatever.
Right. Mm-hmm.
But when we reported for guard duty, and I think there was only one of us on at a time, we would be given one or two of those weapons.
Now, did he put you on the rota as well for the guard duty?
Pardon me?
Did he put you on the rota for guard duty? Were you actually on the schedule?
Oh, yeah, yeah,
uh-huh.
yeah.
And how long did you have to...
Oh, I think we had 8-hour tours for about 2 weeks.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay, and how long until you actually left the building itself and got back to USAID 2?
3 days.
What if anything did you see or hear during those days?
I was pinned down on the street under one of the flower carts on Tudo Street by a sniper on a roof for about 2 hours.
Really? How
yeah.
did you come
first day?
Was that when you were on guard duty?
No, I was going out to get some breakfast around the corner.
And he took a shot at you?
Yeah.
And you scrambled under the cart?
Right.
Wow. 2 hours?
Yeah, about 2 hours, and the white mice, give credit to them.
Uh-huh.
I don't know what they did. I didn't see them catch him or anything, but uh-huh. they were all over the rooftop of that building, and I finally felt it was okay to come out, and nothing ever happened.
Did the shot come close to you?
No.
Okay. But you knew he was up there?
Yeah.
Okay. What else did you hear or observe? In addition to that, probably very
Oh,
harrowing.
Gee, we did everything wonderful. It was like I don't know. We would go to the top of the Rex Hotel.
Sometimes
early in the afternoon, if we knew there was going to be some action across the river.
Right.
And watch everything happen, watch the tremendous firefights, and particularly the aerial bombing and shooting.
Uh-huh.
Like, you know, being really in a movie in a war.
Yeah, and other people from MACV or CORDS that you knew were up there as well?
Yeah.
Okay. And what'd you do? Have a drink and have dinner and watch
that sounds terrible, but you're right.
But, I just wonder. I mean, the atmosphere must have been
And that didn't happen
strange.
Every day.
No. But very strange atmosphere.
Yeah.
And
from it being, you know, half a mile away.
Yeah.
And a river in between you.
And that.
And you're sitting there having a drink. It's a weird feeling.
Very strange. And I think it's important to convey some of that, you know, some of those kind of disconnects in a way about the whole experience. Did you go back to USAID then after a couple, 3 days, you said?
Yeah.
And what was...
Continued my routine.
Okay, was it still a routine or was it a little more charged up because of
development? It was always busy.
Yeah, okay.
But it was a couple... I don't know, 3 days after that. I unfortunately don't have the dates of the, I do have some reference points that I'll cover.
Okay, uh-huh, go ahead.
That I was, Larry said, okay, you're going to go to deliver the money. And I said, what? And he said, oh, yeah, that's right, I hadn't told you about that. You and a Vietnamese Army major are going to get in an Air America C-45, and there's some pictures of that you got.
Mm-hmm.
And you're going to fly around the country and take real money. Millions and millions of dollars of piastres. The little Vietnamese major is going to have the money in his briefcase. And you're going to go see that, as far as you can tell, he gives it to the right person. And we did that.
And what was it?
Well, most of the provinces in I Corps... And about a dozen provinces in 4 Corps.
And you flew into almost every province then?
Yes. Yeah, you got pictures of that too.
Uh-huh. In the course of about how long did it take you to make
all of these? 2 weeks.
Okay. And who was the South Vietnamese major that you
were
with?
I have no idea. There were two of them.
Two different guys?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And that's the only time we ever saw each other.
Okay. Did you get along with them okay?
Well, I'll be quite frank, I didn't speak Vietnamese. They may have spoken good English, but we didn't get involved in a one-on-one buddy chat. He sat in his seat and I sat in my seat. And after we introduced ourselves, you know, politely, and that was about the extent of it. It was business.
Okay. What about the crew of the aircraft? How many people from America?
The pilot and a co-pilot in that airplane.
And did you stay with the same aircraft and crew the whole
time? No, different crews, different times.
Really?
And different airplanes. I'll talk to you about that, too.
Okay, sure. Go ahead.
But that was the main thing, the little C-45, unarmed. In retrospect, kind of a scary experience. At the time, that was the job that needed to be done.
And
we would usually meet with a province senior advisor, an American guy, and the province chief to give the money. But in many instances, they were dead. And so it would be some stand-in that the Vietnamese major had some understanding of who or what he was looking for. I couldn't tell you whether it was a Viet Cong stand-in or not, but he seemed to know.
Mm-hmm. And the U.S. Official who was there, was that usually an AID employee or a...
No, it was military.
It was a military guy.
Lieutenant colonel in most cases.
Okay.
With a notable except, well, that's a whole different story.
Oh, well, go ahead and tell it.
There was and it gives you a time frame.
Sure.
I went into Hue, Imperial City of Hue, you know where that was?
Yes, sir.
One of the major, major battles.
That's right.
2 days after the Marines, theoretically or officially or whatever, had taken it back. Wrong. They hadn't taken it back at all. Well, yeah, they had for the most part, but there was still a lot of crap going on.
Okay.
I went up there. The province senior advisor was killed, was shot in the head through the windshield of his car.
Okay.
And I was sent up there to kind of assess the situation, give a little interim guidance until a new guy arrived on the scene, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
One of my most scary moments.
Okay.
The same little C-45, unarmed. No. Yeah, it was. That was it. It was when they came to get me out. Yeah, okay.
Okay.
Took me in, dropped me off at the end of the runway, and took off.
Okay.
And I, you know, said, Jesus Christ, where am I?
They left you there, right?
Yeah. And so I kind of got back into the bushes a little bit to see what was going to go on. And pretty soon a Jeep comes screaming down the runway with an Army sergeant or something in it. And he says, Bigger. I came out of the bushes and said, yes.
Uh-huh.
He says, get in. We're getting out of here.
Uh-huh.
And they took me back to the headquarters, which I think was partially destroyed. Uh-huh. And we looked at the car and the bullet hole. And I stayed for a couple, 3 days, made some calls back to Saigon with asking for some interim guidance and that sort of stuff.
Right.
And then the new guy showed up from someplace. He wasn't new to the business. He came from a smaller province.
Mm-hmm.
And they came in this time to get me in a French airplane called the Palatius, P-I-L-A-T-E-O-U-S.
Okay.
Pilot, P-I-L-A-T-E.
The Palatius Pilot?
Right.
Uh-huh.
It was a French airplane with a C-130 turboprop jet engine.
Okay.
It could climb almost straight into the sky. The purpose for it was to go into places where the Viet Cong would wait at the end of the airfield to take out airplanes.
Okay.
This
yeah.
rascal, in about 500 feet, would point its nose up and go straight up. And I was in one that had this set up for the pilot and three passengers. I was in one this one time that there were five of us. They diverted it in to pick me up when they found out how dangerous it was getting out of there.
Mm-hmm.
It had five people in it, and what a ride that was.
Just basically almost vertical right
yeah,
off the...
Yeah, yeah, like jets can do.
Wow. that hit you with some G's. Huh?
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that was fun. And I don't think I even had a seatbelt.
And you were in Hawaii for a couple, 3 days?
3 days, I think.
Okay. What else did
you
see?
I did not get around much.
Uh-huh.
I do have some pictures.
Okay.
Some of the things that were destroyed, and strangely enough in that war, how others were left untouched, and nobody knows why.
Mm-hmm. And did you see any more of the actual fighting?
No, I did not witness any mm-hmm. Face-to-face combat in Hawaii, but I've got some other stories to tell.
Oh, okay. And who did you actually talk to when you called down to Saigon?
I think I talked to Marinelli mostly.
Uh-huh. And were you giving him sit reps on what was going on at
yeah.
that point?
Uh-huh. Yeah. And he was passing them on, I'm sure, up the line to McManaway and ultimately, to the command section.
Okay. And were you, how would you describe what you were actually doing, what your position was while you were there in Hawaii? Were you kind of guiding things through the last part of the conflict?
In an informal, interim manner,
mm-hmm.
They went about their business pretty much as they saw it. They would come and ask me for advice or come and tell me what they were doing. That's where I came upon the idea that we had enough cement to pave the entire country of Vietnam, but to use it to build buildings, there was no money to buy roofs or put in doors or windows or whatever. And I came back and went and staffed an idea called cash in lieu of cement.
Mm-hmm.
And we diverted millions of dollars away from the cement. And the cement lobby must have had a hell of a arm on the DOD for the amount of cement that was going to that country.
Okay. Yeah, there was something, Accords program, I think, that was, what was it, 225 or something like that, or 1010-5, where they're giving out cement to refugees
yeah.
after Tet.
Yeah, and we substantially revised the nature of that to
mm-hmm.
put some money into the program so that something could be done with the cement.
Okay. And this was all, as you indicate, American cement that was being shipped over there under contract.
Yeah, and I don't know the details
sure,
of all of that.
Sure.
I probably shouldn't have made
no,
the comment
that's
that
fine.
I did.
That's fine. I think I know where you're going with that. Tell me, Kay, was the time that you spent in Hue before or after the Piastre flights?
Before and after.
Okay, okay.
That gives you a reference point.
Yes, it does.
And what was the date that we said we had Hue? I don't know, sometime in mid-February.
Right, maybe the 18th or something like that.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. The mission continued then, the Piastre flights continued after you'd spent 3 days in Hue.
Pardon me?
The Piastre flights continued then after you had been in Hue.
Yeah, is there something right
now? Okay.
Yes, go ahead.
Okay. Your Piastre flights, what was the purpose of that money?
To regenerate the economy.
Okay. And it was being delivered to the local official, whoever?
Yeah, the senior province chief.
Mm-hmm. And under the...
And what he did with it? Who knows?
Okay. Was there any kind of accounting being done around that money, do you know?
Not that I'm aware of, that I was involved in.
Okay.
I delivered it, left, and that was the last I heard of it.
Okay. Can you say where this handover of money fit into the general program that CORDS was developing for recovery from Hue, or from the Tet Offensive?
Money talks. It was probably the most important, significant thing
mm-hmm.
that happened to get the country back operating again. And I was just a little bitty guy in the middle of it.
Uh-huh. And you were helping move the money around.
Yes.
And it was actually...
And there must have been another counterpart or two of mine that I didn't know about that went to the places I didn't go.
Okay.
As I told you, I did most of the provinces... In I Corps, which I think are like 13,
mm-hmm.
and I think I did 8 or 10 in 4 Corps, the Delta.
Okay. So there was another effort probably in other areas.
Yeah, but not that I'm aware of, but I
Where did money actually come from? How did it get into the briefcase? Do you know any?
Yeah, the Vietnamese major went to the National Bank of... South Vietnam or whatever it was at 6 o'clock in the morning and picked it up and met me at the airplane at 7 and we took off.
And were you given any additional briefing on what you were supposed to do if, say, something went wrong?
No.
Nothing?
No.
Wow. But nothing ever did really go wrong, is that right? It was pretty smooth?
Well, except for one time in the Delta,
mm-hmm.
I got... In between a firefight, and a helicopter came in and pulled me out. That was a nice moment.
Yeah, can you describe what happened on that day?
Yeah, I think after we delivered the stuff to the... No, I was alone on that one. What was I doing down there? That wasn't a money flight. That was just to go drink some coconut milk with the province chief
mm-hmm.
and... Give him some guidance or hand him some papers or do something. Yeah, that wasn't the money flight.
Oh, okay. That must have been later on.
But it was the same kind of thing.
Uh-huh. But what...
But on the, after leaving him, and a jeep took me out to a helipad to be picked up, you know,
uh-huh.
in a few minutes or whatever. And on one side of that helipad, there were VC. On the other side... There were RVN, and they decided they'd shoot at each other for a while. And so I kind of kept a low profile till that helicopter came in.
And what kind of a helicopter was it? Was it a...
It was an Army one this time.
Uh-huh.
It wasn't Air America.
Okay.
And I think they came in with some suppressing fire to get me. Now, I can't tell you how many rounds were shot and that sort of thing,
mm-hmm.
but it was an armed helicopter with machine guns and two guys manning the machine guns.
And you were alone?
Yeah.
On the ground? And
yeah.
And you scrambled aboard? Is that
yeah.
kind of how it
yeah.
went?
Yeah.
And then they got you the you-know-what out of there?
Out of there, yeah.
Wow.
Nice
wow.
nice minute.
Yeah. Did you Where did they fly you to? Do you know?
Back to Saigon.
Okay. Yeah. Did you have a chance?
Tonsonut.
Did you have a chance to speak to any of those guys on that flight?
No. No, not really.
Not really? Maybe to say
Except
thanks?
To say thanks.
Yeah, I was going to say.
Yeah.
And you never saw them again, I'm sure.
No.
Okay. Are you thinking, Kay, that that was later on during your tour?
That was immediately after Tet, but it was not a money run.
Okay.
Now that I, you know, really think about it.
Okay. And
what else did I do?
I
spent some time on different flights, some of them the money trips, visiting with Green Berets and or other Army units, and there are some shots in there of, I think one was the mess hall tent, another one's a picture of a Jeep, or whatever. So I was in the field, but I was not, I was not out there on combat patrol or
in heavy
enemy action.
Or, right, there were other guys who were doing that.
Yeah, regular Army guys.
Mm-hmm. When you went out to
Colin Powell was doing that while I was living a life of luxury.
And now look.
But I was the Air Force John Kerry, except I didn't kill anybody.
Well, now when you say you were the Air Force John Kerry, why do you say that?
No, because I was out there in the middle of it, in the Delta.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't on board his little boat.
Right. But you know, you had your feet on the ground. And
I was on a couple of those riverine boats, not in combat circumstances. But I've also got some pictures of that and the stuff that I sent you.
When you would go out of Saigon on some of these trips, now not the money trips, but later on, what kinds of missions did you have? Were these for you to get an observational view of what was happening? Or?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Observational view and or take some guidance, written instructions or whatever.
Mm-hmm. You were conveying
verbal
things.
Instructions that maybe I had been given from somebody.
Okay.
Yeah.
And were those usually related to CORDS activities?
CORDS activities. I never had anything to do with regular American military combat.
Now, Kay, it's said that in early May of 1968, there was kind of a mini Tet offensive around Saigon and Jhelum province. And I wonder if you remember anything about that.
I remember that there was, but I don't think it was that big a deal.
Okay.
Or it wasn't as far as I knew. Now, maybe you've seen stuff that indicates that it was, but recollection, it wasn't that big a deal.
I just wondered if it dislocated the recovery efforts at all.
No, I don't think so.
Okay.
Not from my perspective.
Okay. And things then, after Tet, things in the CORDS office, you would say, got back to business? Effectively.
Yeah, we got heavily involved because we proved that there was some value to CORDS, to the doubters, and so we put together the massive publication document to serve as the budget for 1968 money had already been approved for 1969, which was a substantial increase, but I don't think it ever happened as of happened to the whole... The whole lessening of interest in the Vietnam situation, the resignation of President Johnson, and that sort of stuff.
Mm-hmm. Now, do you remember hearing about his announcement that he was not going to run for another term?
Yeah, I don't think I got that in any official message traffic. I think the media broke that first.
Okay. And what sort of media did you have access to?
Stars and Stripes.
Uh-huh.
And
else?
There were a couple of local Saigon makeshift English newspapers.
Okay. Soon thereafter, Bob McNamara left office as the Secretary of Defense and was replaced by Clark Clifford. Do you remember that at all?
I remember that, but I think Clifford came to Vietnam, but I didn't see him.
Yes, I think he came in the summer of 1968, and you didn't see him at all?
No.
Okay.
I think I was aware of the fact that he was there.
Sure, sure.
And I think an ex-buddy of mine was in the party, and we visited by phone very briefly.
Oh, okay. Uh-huh. Do you remember a couple of other events of that spring and summer? that happened in the States, and if they had any effect on what you were doing or what you were seeing would be very interesting. For example, the death of Dr. Martin Luther King. I wonder if you remember that.
Well, I was aware of that, but I don't think that had any, in my observation of viewpoint, had any impact on what was happening in Vietnam. No, may well have had elsewhere or places I don't know about. But.
What about Robert Kennedy, who was seeking the Democratic nomination at that time? Did you hear about that?
Yeah, through the media.
Again, nothing official.
No big deal. No.
Okay. And Kay, were you aware of the escalating anti-war protests at this time in the States?
I think I was generally aware of it. I knew about the Kent State thing or whatever it was, but it didn't translate into anything that I received in terms of official guidance on what to do or what not to do or any impact on what I was involved in.
Okay. And it, I think, is also the case that in the spring and summer of 1968, Bill Colby was becoming more of a central figure.
Yes, he moved up to be number two to Ellsworth Bunker, the titular ambassador. But Colby was the guy that was there on the day-to-day scene with General Westmoreland.
Now, you said earlier that you had met Colby a couple of times.
A couple of times, yeah.
Under what
I didn't call him Bill. I called him Mr. Ambassador.
Yes, sir. Under what circumstances did you see him?
In his office when I would bring a paper and brief it.
And did you stay with him for any length of time there, or just giving an overview of the paper?
Maybe 5 minutes.
Okay. Did you have an impression of him that you could share with us?
Yeah, great. In spite of all the things that have been said.
He was
a top-notch guy.
He was very active here at Texas Tech with the Vietnam Center here.
Yeah.
I just wondered...
And I also met the Admiral once. What's his name?
Zumwalt?
Yeah, Zumwalt.
Oh, you did?
When he was in the River Marine Force, and I was involved in coordinating some transportation things.
Okay. What was your impression of him then?
Strong, military. No nonsense.
Yes, sir.
But he was approachable.
Mm-hmm.
I called him General. He didn't call me Kay either, I don't think. And I think the reason I met him was I had arranged for Air America to take a commercial contractor who had barges operating in the Delta. And I arranged for Air America to fly him over those assets so that he could assess what they were doing. And I think the reason I went to brief Zumwalt was to let him know that that was happening so that his riverine people would know what was going on.
Yes, and not take any untoward action.
Right.
Why were you employing Air America for that kind of a job? Do you remember?
Air America did most of the work over there that was not involved in direct combat operations. There was some Air Force logistic capability with cargo planes and that sort of thing, but that was in support of the active military involvement. Everything that supported CORDS, with a few exceptions, like I said, an Army helicopter picked me up once, was supported by Air America, as well as were most of the activities over Laos and Cambodia. These were one tough, brave group of guys.
About how much in the way of either personnel or aircraft assets did Air America have in Saigon that you knew about?
I didn't know about the total assets.
Okay.
I know there must have been 200 pilots. How many aircraft, other than the ones I saw and flew on, I don't know, but there must have been. Oh, and one of the other ones that I flew on, getting out of Da Nang. I never told you that story, did I?
No, what happened there?
I went up to Da Nang to do a staff visit before Tet. I was up there by, I guess, about 3 days, went on to the island where the Marine headquarters was, or the 3rd Marine Amphibious Force, or whatever it was, and they ran the store. Mac V may have thought that those Marines were under Mac V, but the Marines did what they wanted to do when they wanted to do it, and a hell of a good job.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And in the Cords area, they had their own group, and we would, you know, share stuff with them, but they do it their way.
What was the name of that group? Do you remember? Or its activities generally?
Yeah, they were. I told you the Army group's name were Combined Action Platoons.
Yes, that was the Army.
That was a similar name in the Marine Corps, but it was different, and I can't recall it right now.
They
operated aside from the regular Marine, you know, heavy armor, heavy infantry attack units.
And they were doing pacification.
And they did good work.
They were doing pacification type work?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, they would go out into villages and do medical stuff and, and help them build things and, you know, all that kind of stuff.
Okay. And that...
A parallel operation to what CORS was.
And there was some communication there, but no control between the
two.
No
control.
Okay. But you did have some kind of liaison with them at this, at least during this
mission? Yeah, during the time I was in Da Nang. And then I think I had not really much liaison with them during the rest of the time.
Okay. Now, what about the CIA? Were they also involved in pacification efforts to some extent?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
One guy in my office in particular.
Who was that?
Can't think of his name.
Okay. But someone within plans and programs?
Right.
Okay. And he was like liaison with what the CIA
Yeah,
was
what
doing?
We called it then, the Office of the Special Assistant.
Okay. And they had their own kind of program going?
Yeah, and I don't know much about it.
Okay. Did you know anything about it?
Yeah, that it was very intensive and that they made independent assessments and studies from headquarters MACV, which at times were at odds.
Okay. Did you see any of their traffic or reports? Or
some,
any of that?
Not a lot.
And, well, while we're on this subject, can I also ask you?
They were like the Marines. They operated on their own.
They were kind of out there, huh?
Yeah.
Do you have any idea how many personnel were associated with their pacification efforts? They're in Saigon, say, in the plan?
No, I don't, but the majority of the people were that were out, you know, in the offices or in the field or that sort of thing, were USAID people.
Okay.
And they were probably 10 to 15,000.
Okay.
I mean, it was a big effort.
And as you say, they were working on pacification things that paralleled what you were doing.
Yeah, they do agriculture stuff and commerce stuff, and, you know, the real nitty-gritty work. We'd give them the guidance, and they'd go do it.
Okay. And during 1968, there was a growing initiative, which you alluded to before, called the Phoenix Program.
Yeah.
And I wonder if you can tell me anything about that.
Yeah, that was interesting.
Uh-huh.
I was told one day about that and then given, you know, very skimpy details of what it was and said, set that up. And I saluted smartly and said, yes, sir. And then tried to figure out what that meant. And what it meant was that I supervised some remodeling of a balcony area over the back end of the USAID 2 building to make them a bunch of offices. And one day, five of the meanest-looking Army military police guys showed up and said, what do we do? And I said, you go to your office and do whatever you're supposed to do. And then I would coordinate with them a little bit, but I did not get involved in any direct operations, and I didn't kill anybody.
And so what you were doing is making making a set of offices for them to operate from?
Yeah.
Okay, and then kind of, you know, just knowing that they were there.
There, would coordinate with them as appropriate.
Right.
Phoenix was a pretty close-held operation.
Yes, yes, sir. And fairly small at that point.
Yeah, five guys.
Yeah. And
but then there were lots of people, other things that were happening that they controlled out in the real Army. Long-range patrols, for example, were part of Phoenix. The SEALs were part of Phoenix.
The Green Berets were part of Phoenix. There were some other, there was a thing called the Studies and Observation Group, which sounds very innocuous.
Mm-hmm.
But they were deeply involved in black operations.
And, Kay, did you know much about what was going on back there while it was happening?
Probably not aware of the details or the impact of it that I've since learned about as I've read things.
Right.
And I say, oh, my God, I was there and I had a part of that.
Yeah.
You know, part of being involved in it.
Mm-hmm. Just a small piece of administering.
Administering it, yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. And how do you feel about what you've learned about the program subsequently? A lot of this is in the secondary literature, a couple, three books written about it now. Have you given thought to that, and does it trouble you at all?
It probably troubles me, but I think it was necessary.
Okay, well,
that it got out of hand on occasion is unfortunate.
Yeah.
But what it was intended to do, to root out the infrastructure of Viet Cong controlled officials in cities, whether they were Viet Cong or not, is unfortunate, but it was necessary, and it probably had a lot of effect.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Did you have anything to do with the growth of that program or oversee the growth of that program? In other words, more offices, more space as the scope of the activity?
No, I did not.
Okay. And did those five guys stay in the USAID building?
Yeah, as long as I was there.
Okay, and I'm sure you're not aware of what happened after that.
No.
Yeah. Was that staff growing while you were there? Did it grow from those
I'm sure
guys?
It was, but I didn't participate in the growth of it.
I see. Now, I wanted to ask you also about some of the allies of the United States and if you came across or had dealings
with
them.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Australians were there.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't do a lot from a combat standpoint that I'm aware of, but I think there have been things that have been written about what they did. And as I say, the first couple of nights I was there, I had an Aussie lieutenant colonel for a roommate.
Right.
But, you know, we didn't talk much about substantive things.
Mm-hmm.
The biggest one, and what I'm so happy is happening now,
mm-hmm.
we had, I don't know how many thousand, but substantial, like 15 or 20,000 Koreans. They were mean. They were big. They weren't like, you know, little frail Koreans we think of as a stereotype.
Uh-huh.
These guys were giants, and the Viet Cong wouldn't mess with them.
Yeah, they were called the Rocks, weren't they?
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep. Yep.
In what capacity did you come across these guys?
Well, I was involved in an organization initially that was called what? Some kind of an acronym for all the countries that were involved in the Vietnam effort. They had periodic meetings until Tet happened, and they were administrative in nature and were shake hands and do nothing. And I forget what that was, except I wore a special patch on one of my buttonholes for that thing, and I can't remember what the name of it was. Was not too consequential, I don't think, except I would meet some Koreans there.
Uh-huh. And this was some kind of diplomatic sort of...
Oh, it was an official organization.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But would you say more of a talking shop or kind
yeah.
of a feel-good
yeah.
feel kind
As
of...
As I saw it.
Okay. Well, I think, sir, you're probably in a position to know whether substantive things were, you know, happening or not.
It met at the racetrack.
It met at the racetrack?
Yeah.
Okay. Can you describe that? Where was the racetrack?
Racetrack was over by Cholon.
Mm-hmm. And was there a meeting?
It was there. It was a you know, kind of a club-like thing.
Okay, sure.
Yeah.
Uh huh.
I don't know if they actually had liquor and stuff, but they didn't when we were there. But I think that's where we met.
Mm-hmm. And
in a conference room. No, it wasn't a conference room. I think it was the open bar or whatever area.
Okay. And there were delegates from the different allied military forces there?
Yes.
Okay. As you've said, there were some ROK military people
yeah.
there. And Australians?
Yeah.
And
New Zealanders?
Uh-huh. Okay. Anybody else?
Yeah, whoever else was there, and I can't remember.
Well, South Vietnamese people, maybe.
No, I don't think the South Vietnamese participated in this group.
Okay, uh-huh.
Whatever other countries were there, and there weren't many, and they didn't have much impact.
Okay, any Filipinos there, or?
I think so, yeah.
Maybe some Thai?
Filipinos had a very, very big investment in Vietnam in terms of contracts.
How do you mean?
Like I said, the guy that I talked to you about that I arranged the trip to fly over all his barges in the Delta.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that was just one little operation. But probably other than Brown and Root, disrepute or whatever,
mm-hmm.
The Filipinos had as much contracting and much stuff going on, far less than Brown and Root, of course, but had a lot.
Uh-huh. In what kinds of areas? Shipping?
Support.
Road building?
Logistics.
Oh really? Okay.
Road building, yeah.
Uh-huh.
I think they were building the... have you got a loop around Lubbock?
Yes, we do. Uh-huh.
Okay, like the 610 around Houston?
Yes, they were.
Yeah, we were building that around Saigon. Okay. And it kind of got sidetracked when Tet came on.
Okay. Did they ever get back to that?
I don't know.
Mm-hmm. But that was a primarily...
I've never since seen it. I drove on part of it once when it didn't even have cement.
Really?
Yeah.
Huh. What car were you using, do you remember?
I think I had my little staff car and driver then.
Okay.
Because I wouldn't have gotten known how to get out there if it hadn't have been for him.
Okay.
Mr. Hung.
Uh-huh.
Nice little guy. I think he was a VC at night and my driver in the daytime.
Okay. What made you think that?
I don't know. It was just one of those...
Had a feeling?
Yeah.
Okay.
Gutsy feeling. No proof.
Mm-hmm.
No proof.
About how old was he?
He probably was 35.
Did he have a family, do you know?
He did have. I never met him.
Mm-hmm.
Had a little motorcycle, and I think he used to steal gas out of the car to run his motorcycle.
Mm-hmm. That very well
could be. Back one time, I made him take out a contraption out of the trunk of the car that he later tried to tell me was his emergency supply in case we ran out of gas.
Aha. Uh-huh. Okay.
Aha, uh-huh, yeah.
Uh-huh. So the loop road that someone was giving thought to building around Saigon, that was, you think, Filipino contractors were handling some of that?
I think so, but I don't know. I was not involved in that.
Yeah.
But just, you know, they were involved in those kinds of things,
sure.
Logistical things.
Okay, uh-huh. Infrastructure development for the
right.
country. And mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And I want to ask in general your impressions of South Vietnamese military and political figures, particularly the military people you met along the way.
The military people I met were very professional.
Okay.
At the top, uh-huh. I don't think there was a professional or political commitment to do what they should do.
Okay.
Say that they weren't effective in many cases.
Uh-huh. Can you elaborate a little bit on what you mean?
Yeah, I used to go to the RVN mobilization meetings with a half a dozen general officers, or colonels at least, but a fairly high-level representation of the Republic of Vietnam.
Uh-huh. And these...
And they were nice meet to greet, sit with a limited agenda that had nothing of any importance on it for an hour and leave.
Was it frustrating for you?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. What about for other American, either military or civilian people that were around those kinds of meetings? Was there a general sense of frustration?
Well, generally speaking, the ones I went to, I was the only guy.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
Not that there weren't lots of other important things going on elsewhere.
No, sure, sure. But you just kind of felt a little frustrated with...
Yeah, yeah. The best guy that I ever saw had a kind of a non-essential task. He was the chief of the Vietnamese Army... Research and Development Department.
Mm-hmm.
And you want a story?
Sure.
Okay, he also happened to be the owner of a villa that a bunch of guys and I rented to get out of my crummy little tax building. And we had our own cook, Madame Ba, and all that stuff. I think there were four or five of us. And he left us some machine guns and a few things. We had a telephone that he had arranged.
Mm-hmm.
And he wanted us to pay him in dollars, and we wouldn't, but that didn't completely alienate the deal.
Mm-hmm.
And old buddy of mine, Colonel Had Thompson, fighter pilot, who had completed his missions or whatever and came to Saigon to be in ops, invited me to join that group, and I thought, oh, this is better than sitting alone in a
sure.
crummy room.
Yeah, yeah.
And so the Vietnamese colonel invited us one Sunday to go on a research and development ship.
Okay.
And it must have been, I don't know, 200, 300 feet long. It was a big ship. You got some pictures of it.
Okay, uh-huh.
And he took us, he didn't, but he had a couple of Navy lieutenants who he let bring their families, their wives and their children. And we went up and down the Saigon River and got to get into the little harbor of the Saigon Zoo, which was a beautiful place.
Okay.
And
uh-huh.
I think that's why he let the wives and the little kids come, because he got in there, and there's a picture of me on the ground in there, as a matter of fact.
Right, yeah. Yeah.
So that was kind of exciting.
Yeah. Do you remember much about the zoo? Can you describe
Didn't
it?
See that much. Not
okay.
much more than the picture
uh-huh.
shows.
Okay.
No one was allowed in the zoo,
uh-huh.
and we were probably in there if anybody knew it. They'd have come and grabbed us. So we didn't do anything but, you know, go in and take those pictures and sit there for a few minutes and look around
mm-hmm.
and then leave.
Was it busy when you were there?
No, there was nobody in it.
There was no one there?
Well, except the caretakers.
Why?
The guys
why?
Feeding the animals.
Uh-huh. Why was it so deserted?
For security reasons.
Was
Viet Cong could have come right through that rascal.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
Was it ever attacked, to your knowledge?
Not to my knowledge.
Okay. But the...
The Viet Cong never got across the river to that side of the Saigon River.
Okay.
Uh-huh. In that immediate area. Now, they were obviously all over the city.
Right. Right. That's interesting. The zoo comes up quite a bit.
Does it?
Yeah, people used to go there in the earlier years.
Oh, okay, yeah, in the earlier years.
Yeah, as a kind of, you know, sort of haven within the city kind
yeah,
of thing.
So, yeah, that was
yeah.
beautiful.
Yeah. Do you remember any of the animals that they had there?
No, I don't think we saw animals. We
really?
Weren't in that park.
Okay. You saw the caretakers kind of moving around doing their thing?
One or two.
Really? Okay.
Yeah, because if they had seen us, they'd have thrown us out. Well, I don't know what they would have done.
But the head of the R&D department, the guy who made this excursion possible, what
yeah.
was it about him that impressed you, made you think differently about him than other people that you came across in the RV?
I guess maybe because I knew him on a conversational level,
uh-huh.
that he appeared to be a very professional, dedicated kind of guy.
Mm-hmm.
But he didn't have much of a job, so he didn't make much impact on anybody.
Interesting. Did he ever talk to you about his career or why he was in R&D?
No. Hmm. No. We never got to those kind of discussions.
I see. Well, let me ask you about a couple of other figures that
okay.
I don't know whether you actually ever saw them, but maybe you have some kind of opinion about how they functioned and so forth. And the first of those is General Westmoreland.
I never met him.
Uh-huh.
I was in his command headquarters, you know, suite. Lots of times, but I never had a case to see him face to face.
Did you have an impression that you formed either while you were there or in the subsequent years about his command in Vietnam?
Well, yeah, of course, had nothing but positive thoughts about while I served underneath him.
Yes, sir.
And I know he's been very controversial,
mm-hmm.
and I have not really studied that enough to take an opinion,
mm-hmm.
but I guess if you were to ask me which way I would lean, it would be in favor of him having done a hell of a job.
Okay. What about Creighton Abrams, who took his place?
Did not know him
uh-huh.
personally or operate under him that long. I don't recall when he came in. You may know, but I think it was toward the end of 68.
Yes, I think that's right. And General Westmoreland went to D.C. as chief of staff, I believe.
Yeah.
I could be wrong on that.
No, I think you're right.
also there's another figure about whom a very popular book has been written by Neil Sheehan, and he was, I think, associated with chords in three chord. That's John Vann.
Oh, yeah, John Paul Vann?
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, what a renegade he was.
Do you know
he was
a
retired
him?
Army lieutenant colonel.
Yes, sir.
That just talked his way because he was so knowledgeable.
Mm-hmm.
But he was so forward that he held that chords three position as equivalent of a two-star general.
Yes, sir. That's
I
right.
met him twice.
Okay.
And he's everything he's cracked up to be in my opinion.
Really?
Yeah.
What was your, go ahead and tell me your impressions. What circumstances did you meet him, and what were your impressions of him?
I think I met him once when he came to Saigon.
Mm-hmm.
I was in a meeting with him,
mm-hmm.
Had a brief aside, and the other time I didn't go to his headquarters, but I saw him once after that. He recognized me, you know, we had met before,
mm-hmm.
old close friends,
mm-hmm.
didn't eat lunch together, and talked briefly again, and he just exuded everything that he was so supposed to be, rough, tough, take charge, don't give me any crap, and a womanizer.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Okay.
But, you know, don't write that down. Well,
no,
I guess
no,
you
sir.
Have to. I said it.
Well, I don't think it's a secret.
Yeah.
Yeah. And now, Ambassador Bunker, you mentioned before. Can you fill out the picture about him a little bit more?
Went to a party at his house once.
Uh-huh.
Pre-Tet.
And,
assume that I shook his hands in a receiving line.
Okay.
And that was the extent of it.
Did you meet his wife? Do you know?
No.
Okay.
I know she was there
uh-huh.
at times, but I don't think she was there at that particular time.
Okay. Did you have any opinion about how he was doing his job? Maybe you couldn't express it then, but about his relationship with the South Vietnamese government or with General
Westmoreland? Yeah, I think he probably had a pretty good political understanding
uh-huh.
of the various and sundry. Well, when I was there, I think we had three different premiers or presidents
yes.
or whatever they call them.
Yes, sir.
Key and one of the big twos mm-hmm. and the little two, maybe. I don't know.
I think that's right.
And he
sir.
Probably handled that aspect of things great. I don't think he messed around much with Westmoreland. He let Westmoreland run the military part of the show.
Mm-hmm. Now, what about Bob Comer? Did you...
He left shortly after I got there.
Okay, who was he? He was replaced by Colby then.
Yeah.
Okay. And he went back, Comer went back to Washington.
No, he went to be the ambassador to Iran.
I beg your pardon, you're right, sir. Did things...
Which was big-time stuff then.
Yes.
That was considered, in the big scheme of things, more important at that time than was Vietnam, and for reasons that we have yet to learn.
Right, that story continues to unfold, I guess.
Yeah.
And that was, in some way, a kind of a reward to him, do you think?
I think so, yeah.
Okay.
And a need for his skills
mm-hmm.
that maybe didn't work out.
I think you might be right there.
Because I think they fired him, right? Or I think the Iranians asked for him to be... return when they found out what a strong character was, but I don't know that for a fact.
Okay. Now, did you said that you had met him once or twice or saw him?
Yeah, once to actually talk to,
uh-huh.
and maybe once in a staff meeting, you know, that he acknowledged that I was there.
What kind of a guy was he?
Just like he's painted to be.
Which is, in general...
Cocky, arrogant, uh-huh. but so goddamn smart, you don't... really realize that he's cocky and arrogant.
You don't mind quite so much.
No.
Because he's actually got something to back it up.
Yeah.
Okay.
And he was a great personal buddy of his likewise character personnel, John Vann. Peas in a pod.
Is that right?
Yeah. Oh,
okay. And they did get along well, do you
think? Yeah, that's probably why Vann got the job.
I see. Okay.
I don't know that either.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh. Now, Vann's position, was he actually the primary chords person within three corps?
Yes.
Okay.
A Marine was I Corps.
Uh-huh.
Who'd we talk about a few minutes ago? Wayand
mm-hmm.
was three corps, and four corps, I believe, was an Navy Admiral whose name I don't know if I ever really consciously paid any attention to.
Okay. When you would go out on your travels out from Saigon, was it part of your brief to stop in with the Cords HQs in the different core areas?
Not always.
Okay.
The money trips were money only. On the ground, 10, 15 minutes.
Okay.
If one of them happened to be there, I would talk to him.
Uh-huh.
But like I say, in some cases, we don't know who we gave the money to. I'm sure the Vietnamese major knew it was an official person.
Right. They probably had their own system of checking and double-checking.
Yeah. May have been his brother-in-law.
Did you understand, Kay, why you were on those flights?
No. They needed some dummy that knew a little bit about what was going on, but who was expendable. No, that's not true.
Yeah, I was going to say. That doesn't sound quite right.
But I don't know the selection for that.
Okay, you don't know.
I was an Air Force guy, the only one in all of Cords.
There were
a number of, not a large number, but a number of Army guys. No Navy guy, no Marine. And so why not send the Air Force guy?
Okay. You think maybe that has something to do with it?
Yeah, I think it did.
Okay. When moving now towards the second half of your time in...
Pretty uneventful, but go ahead.
Okay. Well, I just wondered if there were certain events or trips away from Saigon or maybe things that happened in the city that you remember that it might be good to add here.
No, the high point was really Tet and the trips that I took as far as things that stand out. The rest of my time was fairly substantial, normal staff work.
Okay.
As I say, putting together the master plan for 1969, which was a book that, I don't know, was 6 inches thick or something.
And that was justification for the budget, essentially?
Right.
Okay.
Uh-huh. Right.
And it argued for expansion?
Yes.
Uh-huh. Of Cords, particularly?
Cords particularly, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And
because Cords saw themselves as the key to success.
And how do you evaluate now with a great deal of perspective what Cords actually achieved, either while you were there or in total?
It was on the way to achieving a lot. It probably had some major successes in certain areas.
Mm-hmm.
But we lost the war.
Right. Why did that happen? Why did we lose the war, sir?
Because the American will to fight the war disappeared.
Was that a problem of politics inside the U.S. rather than of military operations on the
ground?
Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
Tet was a tremendous military success for the United States, but it was never portrayed that way in the American press.
And can you say a bit more about the press and what happened to the war effort as a consequence of their coverage? Do you have a particular take on how the press covered the war?
I think the press has covered the Iraq War far more balanced than they did the Vietnamese War, and primarily because of the embedded reporter scene. Okay, another story.
Okay.
I used to have drinks on occasion, not regularly. We went, that close of buddies, but with, with the kid on CBS, kid to me, he's my age. We were kids then.
Not the anchor.
Yeah.
Dan Rather,
yeah.
Oh, really?
And those other guys.
Uh-huh.
On the, and I'm looking at it right now, on the veranda of the Continental Palace, which you have a picture of.
Yes, sir.
Yeah. And what do I say atop my thing? Favorite watering hole of journalists like Dan Rather and others where I frequently had a drink.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where they would sit and write their stories about what they never saw.
Did you speak to Dan Rather?
Yeah.
What do you remember the flavor of those exchanges?
He was a nobody then, you know.
Yes, I think that's, yes.
Not a nobody, but he was just another little reporter.
Right, that's right.
And so I was a major, and he would talk to me in a civil tone.
Mm-hmm.
And we had, you know, no substantive conversations or anything. And probably that was an overstatement. They sat there with a drink writing up what they never saw about. But it ain't too far from the truth
okay.
either.
Okay, okay. Do you remember some of the other reporters who you saw out there or around town?
Nobody that was a big name.
Mm-hmm.
No, Rather's the only one that stands out.
Uh-huh. But perhaps others who...
Oh, I'm sure there were others there.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
Yeah, they lived in the Caravel Hotel.
Yes, uh-huh.
The best hotel. And it was across the street from the Continental Palace, and the Continental Palace was kind of nice because in the afternoon, after the rain and the breeze came in, it was a pleasant place to sit.
Mm-hmm. And so a lot of them kind of hung out at the hotel.
Two places,
mm-hmm.
Yeah.
My buddy
once got me an invite to go to the top floor of the Caravel Hotel to watch, because it was closer to the river,
okay,
to watch the fighting across the river. And boy, that was an interesting afternoon.
And how long were you up there, do you know?
Oh, 2-3 hours.
What'd you see?
Oh, everything. All kinds of aircraft.
Yeah.
Hitting ground emplacements.
Yeah.
I don't believe anybody was on the Saigon River, the Navy, in that operation. That was mostly Air Force. Giant explosions.
And who was your buddy over just now? Do you remember?
Can't think of his name.
Okay.
I went to school with him at Fort Bragg,
uh-huh,
and we never had contact after Vietnam.
As you think back on it, did that coursework at Fort Bragg at the JFK school actually set you up very well for what you encountered or
no, not?
Not
at all.
Really?
Not at all. It was primarily a psychological orientation.
Uh-huh.
So that we went there convinced it was a real war we had to fight. It wasn't a civil war. And we were supposed to believe some of the things that have since been proven untrue, like what about the Gulf of Tonkin incident?
Mm-hmm.
There are as many aspects to that story as you want, but it was a thing that the administration hung their hat on,
mm-hmm,
to go into Vietnam full force, as did weapons of mass destruction initially lead Bush to that he's now trying to back away from.
Right.
You know, boy, too political. I better be careful.
No, that's okay. Well, I mean, you can say whatever you have on board to say, really. I wanted to ask you also, sir, did you get any medals or citations?
Yeah, I sent you a list.
Yes. Yes, you did.
The biggest one was a Bronze Star.
Yes, sir. Can you tell about the circumstances?
That was for the trips to the field on the money deals and the other operations that I was involved in under combat conditions.
And were there any particular events that the award of that medal was tied to? For example, the time that you came
I suppose
on?
The Hawaii trip.
Uh huh.
Maybe the gun battle incident in the Delta.
Uh huh.
But the trips in general, the fact that I was out in the field with my feet on the ground.
Right. And sir, are you proud of having gotten those citations?
Oh, of course.
Yeah.
And the one other one that I got,
mm-hmm,
was a Republic of Vietnam Medal First Class, which wasn't a giveaway like so many others were. And I got that for my work with the Vietnamese.
And
that's special. There probably aren't many of them out there.
Yes, sir. I think that's correct. I frankly have never seen any listing of an award of those for anyone that I've talked to. And you think that was for the cooperative efforts that you led from CORDS to South Vietnamese government officials?
Correct.
Okay. I want to ask you a couple of questions about Vietnam that really focus on and draw out from your personnel experience.
Okay.
Sir, as you know, almost everyone who shipped over there in any kind of military capacity served a one-year tour, and that distinguished the Vietnam conflict from previous American conflicts, for example, in World War II, when you were in the service you were in until you were let go, in fact, until the conflict was over. And I wonder, do you think this was a strength or a weakness of
weakness.
Personal administration?
Weakness.
Why would that be?
No continuity.
Okay.
People come and go every day.
Uh-huh.
There's no no camaraderie or little camaraderie. The organizations, the military organizations, were not as well trained as they should have been. The concept now that we're doing is to send in a division for a year and pull them out and send another one is much better.
Okay, because it keeps the unit together
over
the course of something.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. And in your mind, as a personnel expert, did this undermine efficiency and proficiency?
Oh, you bet. Okay. Think about the fraggings we had. Have you heard of any of those in Iraq yet?
No, sir.
Well, probably because we don't talk about it, but I don't think they happen.
That could be. Did you come across examples of that kind of misconduct while you were over there?
Not personally.
Did you hear about it, though?
Yes.
Okay.
My three guys, I'm sure, had their snorts of whatever it was. It was a popular drug, but it never affected their duty performance.
By your three guys, who do you mean?
My three enlisted guys.
Oh, okay. Yeah. These were aides to you?
No, they were my sergeant, administrative sergeant,
uh-huh.
and the two guys that assisted him and did all the running. And
they executed what you told them to execute, basically.
Well, yeah, from a logistical and a, they didn't have any part in doctrine or
right.
guidance, or formal military,
right?
You know, that kind of stuff.
But you dispatched them on certain things to do.
Yeah, my sergeant and his two sidekicks that did what I told them to do.
Right. Now, were those the same guys, were those same men assigned to you throughout the time you were there, or did they also
rotate? The whole period of time.
Okay. So they
they were there when I got there,
and
were still there when I left, to the best of my recollection, although a guy emailed me the other day and said, it was my pleasure to serve under you, sir, and I don't remember it.
Really?
Yeah.
Did it make you feel good, though, anyway?
Yeah.
He remembered you?
Yeah.
Sir,
I told you, one of those kids, the father was a previous ambassador.
Oh,
remember that?
Dubrow?
Yes.
Okay. He was the one who emailed you?
No.
Oh, okay. Oh, but he was one
the guy
of
that emailed me. I don't remember him being there, but
maybe
he was.
I'm sorry. Sure. Sir, I want to ask you about another area, again, personnel administration-wise, that came, I think, to the fore in the time you were over there and in years subsequently within the U.S. military, and that has to do with race relations.
Yeah. I didn't do anything in race relations in Vietnam. I do not think we had a big race relations problem from my perspective, but I read numbers of reports about how there were problems out in the field units.
But that was in the course.
If you want to talk about race relations, I've got a whole story on that for you that we'll take up probably not today.
Okay.
If you're interested.
Yes, I'm very interested. I'll make a note and we'll talk about it maybe next time.
Good.
But you didn't, the reports that you saw while you were in Vietnam were basically material that you came across in the course of your reading and monitoring of the traffic.
Yeah, I did not have any personal knowledge of a fragging.
Mm-hmm.
I did not have any personal knowledge of the Milay, massacre.
Right. Did you, though, just in the
course... I don't think that even happened when I was there.
No, I think that's correct. I think that was later in 69 after you had left. But while you were there, just in the course of, just being around military people in Saigon and out in the field when you would go out on your trips, did you ever catch something that you felt was about race just on the edge of a remark or something like that? Did you ever make any observations?
No, because most of my trips I never saw another American.
Okay.
Except for the province senior advisor, who would be a lieutenant colonel, and probably was above the fray on that stuff.
Yes. Okay. So it just didn't hit the radar.
It was a non-entity to me personally.
Okay. Just didn't hit your radar.
In Vietnam.
Mm-hmm. But
I've
otherwise.
Plenty of experience with it since then.
Yes, sir. I do want to have a chance to talk to you about those other events because the entirety of your career is of interest to us. As you were getting closer to, first I want to ask if you went on any R&Rs.
Yeah, I went to Hawaii and I think July. I met my wife for, what did we get, 5 days R&R or
uh-huh,
something?
Uh-huh.
Yeah, that was kind of nice.
Yeah.
That was very, very nice. What an interesting incident from there.
Sure. What happened?
We came up to our room to take a nap.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, dumb guy. I knew I was going to change clothes. So I took all the stuff out of my pockets, including my wallet, and put them on the dresser,
mm-hmm.
which was near to the door. Well, you know, I'm a non-suspecting guy.
Sure.
And they were stolen.
Oh, no.
We reported it to the house management. Cops swarmed the place. Nobody was found. But my billfold was in a potted plant with the money in it.
With the money still in it?
Yeah.
Did they take anything?
No.
Nothing?
Well, they took the billfold, but the cops got there so fast that they made their break and didn't have time to take money. Well, it wasn't that much money in it anyway, I don't think.
But they didn't steal your ID or anything?
No. No, fortunately.
Yes, yes. Was it tough for you to leave your wife again after the R&R was over?
I'm sure it was, but I'm not that kind of guy.
Okay. And when you returned back to Saigon, was the adjustment fine for you? You just kind of went back to work?
Yeah, just went back to work. Next day was work.
Okay. And, you know, a lot of Vietnam veterans, many of whom were not as senior as you, of course, have talked about getting short and getting towards the time when they would rotate out of the country. And I wonder if you had it in your mind at all as you approached December.
I don't think I had a calendar that I marked off the days,
mm-hmm.
but I did arrange to get out of there 1 week short of my 52 weeks.
How did that happen?
Well, I was kind of in control of things.
Okay.
And I felt that it was not shirking my duty. Things were at a kind of a low ebb. My replacement was there.
Uh-huh.
And so I just booked the plane.
Who was your replacement, sir?
Can't remember his name.
Okay. But he was Air Force, obviously.
Yeah, he was.
Okay.
That was an Air Force billet. He was Air Force guy.
Okay. And do you remember where he was coming from?
No.
Mm-hmm. Was he a major?
Yes.
Okay. Okay. And, sir, when were you due for promotion? Do you know?
Well, I was a major then, I guess.
Uh-huh. And
you make major at about 13 to 14 years.
And then,
no, you don't. You make it at about, let me think. Okay. Why don't you got the dates arranged?
Sure. I was just wondering if you were moving.
Officer effectiveness reports that I managed to get two of helped me be promoted substantially to Lieutenant Colonel.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. And when did that?
Also, I also did some other good work.
What work would that be, sir?
Well, I'll tell you later.
Oh, okay.
I've been fortunate to have been in command, executive, or command-related jobs out of the mainstream of the Air Force for much of my career. In fact, I think I've spent a fourth of my career in joint service environments. So I've had a lot of unique opportunities for high-level recognition.
And indeed, the work you were doing in Vietnam was very high level work for a major to be doing. Would you agree?
It was, yeah.
Because I think at the beginning you mentioned that there were a couple of people from other branches of the service who were also in the plans and programs group.
Yeah, they were primarily backroom guys that dealt with dollars.
Right, and they
didn't have the visibility that I did.
Right. And they were in rank above you, even although
one lieutenant colonel, one major.
Uh-huh.
Then there was another lieutenant colonel who was over on our ops side, if you want to call it that. His name was Graniter. I remember that, Lieutenant Colonel Graniter.
Okay.
I'm sure he was a very competent, capable guy.
Uh-huh.
But he was very low key, and I'd tell him, you know, I'd say, hey, Graniter, how about you handling this? And he would go do it.
Huh.
but he didn't have the visibility at headquarters, MACV, and that sort of stuff that I did.
Okay.
But he was a very good guy, I'm sure.
Mm-hmm. But, you know, sir, you held very, you know, very responsible position there within Cords, you know, at Major. It's really quite remarkable, the work that you did.
Yeah, there were two Army lieutenant colonels that worked for Clay McManaway, sat outside his desk. One guy would coordinate on everything with his green pen, and if anybody used a green pen anywhere else, they were in trouble.
Okay.
But those two guys were paper pushers. They never, well, they didn't go with me when I took a paper to the command section to brief it. They were there.
They took root.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Yeah. And you were out and about, it sounds like.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Up and down the halls.
Uh-huh. And, sir, when you left Vietnam in December of 1968, do you remember actually the day you left?
Yeah, they had a party. The day before.
The day before? Uh-huh.
Yeah, because I left early in the morning, 6 okay. o'clock in the morning.
Uh-huh.
The day before, I came back after lunch, and the secretaries had put streamers all over the place, bon voyage and all that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And no champagne, though.
No champagne, huh?
Yeah, son of a gun.
Yeah, that's kind of a rook.
Yeah. yeah, it was nice.
Okay. And you mentioned...
And I think, in addition to the 25 guys and gals in my operation who all were there to say bon voyage, a number of the directors of the other things, like the public safety guy and the PSYOPS guy and those guys, came by and said, it's been a pleasure working with you.
And
so that was kind of nice.
Yeah, that made you feel pretty good.
Yeah.
Yeah. You mentioned the gals.
But not good enough to extend.
Well, right, yeah.
They wanted me to resign my commission and take a State Department temporary appointment and stay there. And I said, no thanks.
And why did you reject that kind offer?
Oh, family, I guess.
Okay.
And the instability. Mm-hmm. You know, I was a regular officer. I knew I had a place to hang my hat
and
a retirement.
Right. And what
they felt reasonably confident that I did.
Sure, sure. And what they were offering was certainly
probably very temporary in nature, particularly as the war wore down, and there wouldn't have been any job at all.
Did you ever have cause to regret that decision?
No.
Okay. Sir, I want to ask you about the gals in the office you mentioned.
Yeah.
The secretaries, were they civilians?
Yes.
Okay. Employed by the State Department?
By the Agency for International Development.
Okay. Do you remember their names at all, sir?
No.
Okay. Or where they were from?
No.
About how old were they?
30s, I guess.
Okay. Just trying to get a sense of you know, some of the women that served in the...
They were kind of courageous people to be over there.
Yes.
Of course, when they went, it was kind of a plush assignment, I guess. But when Tet hit, that was a kind of a dangerous place for a young single woman to be making her way around the city.
Yes, sir, it was. And it's important that we acknowledge that the civilians that who were over there and did expose themselves to the danger. So I'm glad you mentioned that.
Yeah, Cords was almost 100% civilian employees of one part of the government or not, or another.
Yes, that's right, yeah. And they were working primarily in civilian operations. I mean, they were trying to work the pacification side of the game.
That's right.
Yeah. Sir, where did you go when you came back from Vietnam?
Went to Dyess Air Force Base in Texas, and we can talk a little bit about that.
Okay, sure. What was your assignment there?
I was the director of personnel.
For the entire base?
For the entire base.
Wow.
Two major wings. A B-52 wing with 130 transports, and a tactical airlift command wing with C-130s, the trash haulers, as they said.
How many aircraft were based there, do you know?
Ooh, maybe 50 C-130s, maybe 36, I think that was a unit strength on the B-52s, and 15 refuelers.
Okay. And what was it like for you to adjust being to being back in the States?
Oh, I don't think there's any adjustment at all, except I'm glad to be there.
Okay.
Abilene, where Dias is, was rather a dull town. They had no, except for the little one-block city called Impact, you couldn't buy a drink.
Yes, sir.
Except on the base. Mm-hmm. And so we had lots of people that wanted to be close on the military civilian advisory committee.
Mm-hmm.
Because they could get to come to the base and have a drink.
Right.
That's on the lighter side.
Yes,
had a very good relationship with the military, and they continue to have in Dias. I monitor that on a frequent basis in my various roles in the Air Force Association, which we may or may not have an opportunity to talk about.
I'll make a note of that. The work that you did on the base, could you describe
everything?
Okay.
Ran the clubs, the golf courses, the library, the mess hall. No, I didn't do the mess halls. And all the personnel administration. It was a much greater job in those days than the equivalent job is this day, where they split out the specific personnel related responsibilities from running the clubs and the golf courses and the gyms and all that kind of stuff.
Right. Would you say it's more stratified now?
Yeah.
Okay. And what's the impact of that you've seen over the course of your...
It probably was a good thing, even though I hated to give it up,
mm-hmm.
but it was just too much for one guy to really effectively handle.
Yeah. Just the load.
Yeah.
Was too much. Uh-huh. And how long were you actually at Dias?
I think a year and a half.
Okay. Into 1971?
1970.
Or 1970.
1970, yeah. Okay. Okay, let's talk quickly about Dias because it doesn't take much talk.
Sure. Okay.
Routine assignment. Because of the level and the breadth of responsibility, a very, very successful tour.
Mm-hmm.
From a satisfaction standpoint, close interaction on a daily basis with a wing commander who fortunately held me in pretty good esteem, and then the other wing commander, which is unusual on a base, from another major command, the same kind of relationship, got some pretty nice performance reports out of there.
Okay.
Would have liked to have stayed longer. As far as the job was concerned, wasn't that thrilled with Abilene.
Right.
Don't tell my buddies from Abilene.
Okay.
but was very pleasantly surprised when I was selected for a plum assignment in the military personnel community to become the detachment commander of the 1141st Squadron. What is that? A big name. USAF Special Activities Squadron, which was the organization located in Stuttgart, Germany.
Mm-hmm.
It had the responsibility for the support of all of the NATO units in Europe. I was in support of headquarters, 4th Allied Tactical Air Force at Ramstein.
Which I think most people...
Which we can talk about in the next 15 minutes if you've got
sure.
15 minutes
Absolutely.
Left.
Absolutely, let's go.
All right. I told you what it was.
Yes, and you said it was a plum assignment.
Plum assignment, and because it was the only one that was on an American military base, but it was completely separate from the base. We in 4th Allied Tactical Air Force didn't participate in exercises that the base people had when they put on their flak jackets and stuff. We strode around with our 4A staff badges proudly.
Mm-hmm.
4ATAF felt strongly about physical conditioning because it was a multinational command, and Wednesday afternoons were time off for athletics, theoretically.
Okay.
I doubt many people did much except go to the golf course, but anyway.
Okay.
That was one of the things. Completely independent. My boss was a full colonel in Stuttgart. Would talk to him maybe once a week. I actually worked on a daily basis for a brigadier general who was a director of operations and the senior American officer in 4ATAF. Had the unique relationship with them that when I wanted to talk to them, the door was open and they never bothered me.
Hmm.
I ran the store. Nice job.
Yeah, that sounds pretty good.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. What was your relationship like with others in the multinational command? Can you describe some of that?
Yeah, I think I had a pretty good ongoing relationship with the other military people, whether they be American or other countries, in the areas where I had people functionally working. Like, for example, security policemen. I had a good relationship with the American colonel who was in charge of the multinational security function.
Mm-hmm.
Probably the one I interfaced with most and had even more contact maybe than he did with his people in the field was the colonel that was in charge of the communications element, whatever it was called. And I had the administrative and command responsibility for the people at the half a dozen or so radar site locations that came under his technical prerogative. And I probably visited them as much as he did to look out for their health, welfare, and morale.
How many times did you go out on visits like that?
Oh, probably once every 2 months.
Really?
I'd cover the six of them at least once a year.
Did you make it a point to get out there once a year? And
twice a year.
Twice a year? Oh, I'm sorry. And have kind of hands-on
observation? Yeah, stay for a day or two.
Mm-hmm.
See what they needed. Like one time, some of the places were so threadbare that I made a special request for I don't know how many thousands of dollars through the USAFE welfare fund to get enough carpet to carpet all those places.
Yep.
And in fact, when we cut it up,
uh-huh.
there was enough left over to carpet my office, coincidentally. I don't know how that worked out.
This sounds a little bit like the days in the early 60s when you were in Germany previously.
Yeah.
And
Yeah, except I was the head guy this time.
Yeah, now you're on top of the heap.
Yeah.
But going out and visiting at that time the missile sites.
Yeah.
It sounds like
very similar. Yeah.
And did you enjoy being in Germany again?
Oh yeah, Germany was great.
Okay.
The only thing was I didn't get to travel as much as I would have liked to because the demands of the job were, I gave up half my leave every year because I just needed to be there.
And this was much more sort of 24/7, as they say now.
Yeah, it kind of was.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. If that term existed,
right.
Then it wasn't I sat there at my desk or was out in the field 24 hours a day, but I was on call 24/7.
Sure. Yeah. And it sort of sounds from your description like you enjoyed doing it, though.
I did, and that's where the race relations and drug and alcohol awareness challenges were very, very heavy.
Okay. Can you talk a little bit, just in general terms, about, say, the race relations issue?
Yeah. In my particular group, because it was a highly select group, everyone had to have what we call an SSIR investigation, Special Intelligence Requirements Investigation. I had the cream of the crop of people.
Okay.
We did not have any women at that point in time.
Uh-huh.
I did not have that much of a problem in race relations in my organization because I took a lot of preemptive measures to avoid it. I had a NCO advisory council that I convened once a month to talk about these kinds of issues and make sure they weren't a problem.
Okay.
Or if they saw one somewhere, they had knowledge to deal with it or knew where they could go to get the professional help.
Mm-hmm.
As a matter of fact, my program was emulated by the host base where they had more problems because they had a more diverse element and a lot more people.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
So I had a lot of hands-on work on that, even did some things when I got back in the States in the civilian community working in that area.
Okay. Well, maybe we can explore some of that next time.
Yeah, I don't think there's an awful lot to explore.
Okay.
Except I was very knowledgeable, aware of it, and because of that, I like to think, didn't have many problems.
And you developed a kind of a proactive approach.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, very definitely.
Okay.
Yeah, you got it.
Okay, sir, let's take a break.
Let's do it.
Oh.